You may contribute by PayPal, and if you're not comfortable with that, then you can find an address where you can send a donation. Thank you for being a part of Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
And don't forget, we are worldwide radio. Your world, your life, your mind is what we discuss on Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com.
Revolution. Radio.
Worldwide Internet Radio at freedomslips.com.
You're listening to Revolution Radio here at freedomslips.com, and coming at you next, this is Kerry Cassidy with Whistleblower Radio Project Camelot. So without much further ado, here's Kerry Cassidy. Take it away, Kerry.
Stretched out and purring, waiting for more. Strange shade of stone.
Hi there. This is Kerry Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and I think I got my lines mixed up there a bit. I was sort of competing with my own self for a moment or two, and I apologize for that, but I don't even know if that went out over the air. But at any rate, good evening. I hope everyone's having a lovely day. We've had amazing weather in California, so I just have to say, finally, thank you, because this is May, and we've been having some bizarre wintry-looking weather. Made me want to go to sleep every day lately, but it has changed, or hopefully it's taken a turn for the better. So I know that Californians are really sort of babies when it comes to weather, so I'm sure that the people in the East listening to this could care less and think I'm crazy, but at any rate. Okay, so I just want to say a couple announcements, and then we will get right down to it with our very fascinating guest, I gotta say. Fascinating bio that he's got. I just kind of can't get over that bio at any rate. We'll get into all of that. But first of all, I want to say that Project Camelot is about to move to a whole new site, a whole new look. And Tommy and this amazing team has been working night and day for the last, actually for the last, well, few weeks, but the last couple days, really in a push to get this all out there and done. Not that our site was all that too shabby as it was, but the new site is going to make it so much easier, we think, to navigate, because there were several sites cobbled together in the original Camelot portal and productions and all this, and now you're going to find them all under one URL and one roof, and the main URL will be projectcamelot.tv. But it is still, you will be finding it under projectcamelot.org, projectcamelotportal.com, projectcamelotproductions.com. They will all take you to the same place. So that's going to happen in the next few hours, maybe tomorrow morning. I'm not sure what our timeline is at this point. Lots of last minute fixes, but it's looking really amazing. And we can thank Tommy as the real lead and inspiration for the look and feel of the new site, which is just going to be so much fun. Okay, let me see what else. Oh, tomorrow morning I am going to be interviewed here on Revolution Radio on, Chris Vortex's radio show. And so that will be 11 a.m. Pacific time. For those of you who just can't live another day without my voice. Just kidding. I will be interviewed there myself. And in this case, I do the interviewing, and my guest here is Douglas Dietrich. And that's, I believe, even a relation to Marlena Dietrich, if I remember correctly from the bio. And Douglas, are you there with me?
Yes, thank you so much, ma'am. And that relation is very distant. Obviously, I'm a fan of hers because of the time and the era in which my parents grew up. And certainly she helped to promote the name of Dietrich in a way that no other person has. So thank you for bringing that up. And I think she was a wonderful lady, and there's aspects of her own life that we could go into just briefly, because they involved espionage, and she was recruited to try and assassinate Adolf Hitler. And all of that now is vetted. And so it was just very funny how peripherally my dad briefly came into, in the most tangential sense, into that bit of espionage. So be happy to discuss that whenever you want to veer in such directions. But I'll let you be the adult supervision and kind of get the conversation started, Ms. Cassidy. It's an honor to speak with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yes, absolutely. And likewise, and let me say that I'm going to say right up front that I'm not sure I agree with all of your conclusions. But I just found, I don't know, I stumbled on you somehow, and I'm not even sure how. I can't figure out how I found your name, or somebody must have sent me a radio show. And so what happens is that I heard you talking on a radio show about, you know, the Roswell and your take on things and whatnot. And then I looked up your bio, and I was just blown away by your bio because it's so fascinating. And so what I'm going to ask you to do here is really start out with that. And I hope I don't, you know, bore you to death by asking you to go over your life. But it just sounds so interesting, your life experience and how it kind of put you where, well, where you needed to be in order to know the information that you know at this point. So would you mind going into some of that?
Oh, well, I wouldn't mind at all, but exactly where do you want me to start? Because obviously there's so much of it. If I start with just being born in Taiwan and then coming to the United States, it's something that could take hours. Certainly one of the things I would like to correct from the starting point is that I did notice on the Project Camelot portal that there was definitely, it stated that I was recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence, which it definitely was not the case. A lot of miscommunications can occur because the reality, like reality always is quite convoluted, so I can understand where such misunderstandings could take place. But I believe that what they were referring to on the Project Camelot portal, just to clear this up for anyone who reads that and gets a misunderstanding, is that during my absolutely last year of working with the Department of Defense as a research librarian, I was approached by Lieutenant Commander Robert Hunt of the Office of Naval Intelligence. And I think that nobody at that time in 1992 was really too aware that the base was headed towards base closure. But there was just kind of a general breakdown in the American military system in response to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And as a result, base closures were beginning to happen apace at a rate that I don't think the Pentagon was prepared for. But during that period of time when Governor Clinton of Arkansas, excuse me, was running for president, he was to show up in San Francisco, and that's when Lieutenant Commander Robert Hunt suddenly got recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency, and his handler's name was Graham Fuller at the time, or rather he was recruited by Graham Fuller. He was sent from Alameda Naval Station, from Norfolk, Virginia Naval Station to Alameda Naval Station in San Francisco, and he was sent to organize an assassination on presidential candidate William Jefferson Clinton. So that's how I got involved with the Office of Naval Intelligence in that regard. So he was requesting that I use the resources of the library, which essentially was serving as a kind of community center after the actual Presidio Community Center was burned to the ground by the United States Army themselves, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, during the tremendous child molestation scandal that had taken place in the earlier 1980s. So all of this ultimately led to the Presidio military base closure because of the scandals involving this abortive assassination attempt called, they even had an operational title for it. It was called Operation Mount Rushmore. So it was that, it was the enormous child daycare center scandal, and at which my high school teacher, Gary Willard Hanbright, was federally indicted for assaulting multiple children. He died of AIDS while he was on trial. And if he had not died of AIDS while he was on trial, he would have been indicted for far more than the 14 assaults he had been federally indicted for by a grand jury, which was every single one of those assaults was against a child that was under 4 years old. And
really incredible.
Yeah, it's horrific. But all of these scandals led to the base closure. Ultimately, no one thought Presidio would be closed because it was the Western Defense Command Center, and it was the headquarters of the United States 6th Army. But after a while, there was just only so much. The United States Army, after a while, couldn't even tolerate having the base open. It was just too much negativity and publicity, negative publicity surrounding the base. But because this was in the days when the internet was just beginning, pretty much all of it was smothered up pretty effectively. And that's something that I always have to go into when I'm speaking to a younger audience, because they don't understand just how little information gets into the internet. So I'm sorry, you were going to say something? I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, not at all. well, obviously you have a fount of knowledge behind you there, and I do want to tap into all of it. But I want to come back to this sort of ONI. I actually got that from the blog, and or from your, not blog, but your bio. And what it had said was that you were, now maybe it was the way you worded it, but you said that you were a prime candidate for recruitment as a patsy for the self-proclaimed ONI.
Yeah, for the self-proclaimed Office of Naval Intelligence Officer, Lieutenant Commander Robert Hunt. I'm sure he was what he said he was, just based on all the circumstances that were going on at the time. So that would probably be a good way of phrasing it, would be prime candidate for recruitment as a patsy, most definitely. Now, of course, no one volunteers as a patsy. This is what it came to at the crunch point of Operation Mount Rushmore. When they needed a patsy, they designated myself on the basis of what I'm assuming to be whatever was in their dossier. The problem with whatever was in their dossier was they assumed that I would be happy about this. And it was just a series of circumstantial miracles that I got out of that alive. I mean, basically, here was the situation. This I only put together after the fact, was that you have to think historically, of course, the senior Bush was in the Navy. He was a torpedo pilot during World War II. He had extensive naval connections to the point which he maintained after he took charge of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. He maintained enough of a connection with the Navy where he forced them to name an aircraft carrier after himself while he was still alive. By the way, that's never done. It's like putting your face on a stamp or on a piece of currency. It's not supposed to be done, or a coin. It's not supposed to be done to any living president or celebrity. It's an honor that's reserved for the dead. But he managed to railroad through so that not only is there a George Herbert Walker Bush, the first aircraft carrier, it has his statue on the deck. So this is the kind of power that we're talking about in terms of the connections he has with the Navy. So the idea of the CIA and the Office of the Naval Intelligence working together to put a hit on a gubernatorial candidate who's running against the President of the United States when it's George Bush Sr. makes perfect sense in hindsight. At the time, I'm dealing as a DOD librarian. I had been dishonorably discharged from the United States Marine Corps for an earlier international incident, and that was in 1990 that took place. But in 1991, after the Gulf War was over, they could afford to get rid of me. I was discharged. I was out of the Marine Corps, so you've got a perfect candidate in the sense that I was foreign-born, even though I was a naturalized American citizen, and of course still am. I was a dishonorably discharged Marine. I had an exotic ethno-national background. There was several things in my record, such as a past romantic liaison when I was young, literally in junior college, that I had with a State Department confirmed Sandinista, a young lady who I went to Nicaragua with for a very short period of time during the Civil War, and it was entirely romantic and had nothing to do with politics. And that was a mistake that was to prevent me from getting high-level security clearances the rest of my life, something which I constantly emphasize is that I've never had a high-level security clearance. And in terms of the this perfect storm of ingredients, if I were to be portrayed as somebody who went off and knocked off somebody who's running for president, it probably would look quite acceptable to the American public. So that's what I meant by that. And so I hope that clarifies what I was trying to say in that paragraph.
Well, actually, I'd like to continue into that in a little more depth, because again, and maybe what it requires here is if we were to start out with when you I guess were dishonorably discharged from the Marine Corps, or however you call it, I'm not sure how you call it, and then what happened after that, because you have these, first of all, you somehow, if you know, and I'm just going off your bio here, at some point you were in the Presidio working as what I understood to be assistant librarian or something of that nature.
Originally, and then, yes.
And then you went into the Marine Corps, and then when you came out, you went back there.
Yes, absolutely. It's easier to go back to work for the government than many people think. To put this into perspective for the average civilian, so that they can understand what the government is like and why the nation is being run to the ground. And this has to do so much with all of the documentation that I was exposed to that I was never supposed to be exposed to, having such a low level of security clearance. Basically, what had happened was when I was going to a vocational institute in lieu of high school, I was learning a trade. I was learning how to become, I went into electronics. We had two old naval engineers who were going backwards, telling us about the wonders of the vacuum tube and how computers were going to get bigger and bigger and take up entire city blocks. So that pretty much didn't give me any good start in computers. So I instead transferred over to commercial illustration and was essentially learning how to do admin work in a very old style, because everything about John O'Connell Vocational Institute was a trip back in time. It was stuck in the 50s, like Castro's Cuba. And basically, at that point in history, it was just basically what they called San Quentin Prep. That was the colloquial name for it. And the reason this factors in is because the one woman who I met who was exiled there was the Albanian receptionist who wound up getting me the job at the Department of Defense. She, aside from the fact that Gary Hambright was also my commercial illustrations instructor who was there, who wound up running the child daycare center at the Presidio Military Base. So you're talking about two individuals who wound up working at the Presidio who had that John O'Connell connection. And this young lady who was the Albanian secretary had originally been the secretary to George Moscone, the mayor of San Francisco. She was in the office on the day that Dan White pushed her to the ground, walked into the door, and blew George Moscone away, as well as Harvey Milk, who was the supervisor who had taken his job. And,
oh, wow.
And Dan White, by the way, never went to jail. Dan White wound up killing himself at home 7 years later. So that should tell you how bizarre that entire situation was. And this was a golden opportunity for Dianne Feinstein, because she ultimately succeeded to the mayoralty. And the first thing she did was she got rid of that Albanian secretary, because she was reputed to be a lap secretary for George Moscone, and Dianne Feinstein felt she didn't need a female lap secretary. So she wound up working at John O'Connell, and because she was Albanian, she used to broadcast for the Department of Defense on Radio Free Europe to behind the Iron Curtain into her native homeland of Albania. She was one of the few Americans at that time who spoke the Illyrian language, Shqiptaria. And so she basically said, hey, you know, there's an opening at the DOD for a librarian's aide. Why don't you take that on as a summer job? And that's basically how all of this started, as just another summer job. And so I wound up applying, and the reason I was a shoo-in was not so much because my dad had been a veteran for over 30 years, serving in all the wars that he did, but rather that because he was a veteran, I was a military dependent. And because he had been a veteran for so many years, literally World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and before in the China gunboat patrols, then what had happened was that I was granted a military dependency status, even though he was retired. That meant until I was 21 years old, I was able to get access to the commissary, the post exchange, all the open areas of any open base. So because I had this very, very low level military dependent security clearance where I could walk in and out of the gate through the MPs, then I could work at the Department of Defense Library, which was a civilian library, a federal government agency. The DOD is a civilian agency, just like the Veterans Administration is a civilian agency. They're not military. Then at that point, I could work at a civilian building on site, a military base. So I was on site, the Presidio, as a civilian. Now, the first thing I learned when working for the government is that once you get a job with the government, you can never be fired. You can go to work, you can kick your legs up, you can go to sleep every day. You can disappear for months and come back, and your job will still be there. You clock in every day, pig face drunk, you lie down on a couch, which is what so many of these people did, and you will never be fired. You can go postal. You can start killing all of your fellow office workers. They will send in a SWAT team to take you down, but you'll die employed. You will never, ever, no matter what you do, be fired. And this is why all of my superiors who had incredibly high levels of security clearance, due to the fact that they didn't wind up sleeping with Sandinistas, due to the fact that they got clocked into work every day and showed up on time, had been there forever, sheer seniority gave them enormous security clearances after a while to work with documents, because you had to give them security clearances because their entire job was to work with documents as librarians. Now, because they're, like so many other government workers, 99%, lazy, incompetent, slothful, corrupt, they just said, you do it. And so everything was given to the librarian's aide. Within a year, I was a full-fledged military reference technician. Within 2 years, I was a full-fledged Department of Defense research librarian. So the whole point with all of that is the incredible incompetence and corruption that exposed me, because these people were supposed to be destroying documents that I was not supposed to be looking at. It was always handed down to me, all of these various jobs. There were multiple other factors. The incinerator. We had a multi-$1,000 modified incinerator, very similar to the one that they have at the Central Intelligence Agency headquarters at Langley, Virginia. It's a modified crematoria in our case, because we were dealing with locker boxes of documents and files going back to the Spanish-American War. This is another important aspect of the Department of Defense. They work with information that at that period of time, they took nuclear war very seriously, an electromagnetic pulse from an exploding nuclear warhead overhead or nearby could eliminate everything on circuitry. Not only fry your circuit boards, but it could eliminate everything on a floppy disk. It'll erase memories in computers. And as a result, they kept everything on hard copy and Rolodex. And after a while, there's simply no room. So not so much due to conspiracy, but just due to space issues. They would just take all of these records and documents and destroy them, ones that they felt they didn't need. And believe me, there were plenty of times later on someone would come back and say, hey, we need this and that. Oh, that was ordered destroyed. Oh, gee, that's too bad. It's a national security issue. Well, it's gone now. You know, this would happen all the time. But in my case, specifically with the Presidio military base, we had trailer after trailer up and down the Presidio parade grounds, which basically were loaded with documents going back to the Spanish-American War era, going through World War I, going through World War II. And then what had happened was about 10 years before I showed up as a librarian's aide, somebody who was in charge of the crematoria, who was responsible for documents destruction, was wound up going to work pig-faced drunk, saturated in alcohol, which is flammable, fell bodily into this incinerator because it's that big, because you're putting in locker boxes. Your job is to open them, collate the documentation, make sure that the right documents are there to be burned or destroyed, then close the box, throw it in the incinerator. It's about the size of a child's coffin. We're talking about big, heavy, oaken, wooden locker boxes with metal corners on the end so that they wouldn't shatter open if they fell out of a train, a cargo train during transport or something like that. So these were being fed into the incinerator constantly. The guy fell in with one of those coffins is what we used to call them, wound up burning up 90% of his body. Nobody went near the incinerators again for 10 years. We had 10 years of backed up documents. That was the first assignment I was given, and that, you know, kept me going for the next pretty much almost a decade while dealing with multiple other responsibilities that were assigned to me. One of those responsibilities was I was given liaison status to the officially recognized satanic chaplain of the United States Army, Colonel Michael Aquino. And Colonel Michael Aquino, at that time he was a lieutenant colonel. All the while that I worked with him, he was to retire a full colonel. He basically would use the library's resources to access occult grimoires from the Middle Ages or beyond. These were priceless grimoires that were hundreds of years old. Before the printing press. These were pre-Gutenberg in many cases. And he would access them on the basis of international security. Unlike many people who brag about having a security code where they say, oh, I've got a top secret security clearance. You know, top secret is the absolute rock bottom of all security clearances. After that, there's a series of letter and numeric codes which bring you up higher and higher in terms of your security status. And in terms of the United States president, they usually have a very low security clearance because they're in for about 4 to 8 years. They, in the old days, used to have military experience. Most of them these days don't even have that. So their security clearances are practically non-existent. And whereas a general who's in for 30 years, then spends another 10 years in retirement as a consultant to the military, usually on private contract, somebody like that has enormous security clearances, ones that are far higher than that of his president. So they have far more access to materials than their own commander-in-chief. Well,
okay.
In,
yes. Yeah. Okay, I mean, thank you very much. And that's a very quick and concise overview of what kind of happened. Let me just sort of back up a couple steps and ask you a couple questions in regard to what you've just said. Okay. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you said you talked about how you kind of got stepped up because of this guy dying and because getting access in certain ways. But was this after you were in the Marines?
No, that was well before. By the time I entered the Marines, I was pretty old. I was about 21 or 22 years old. It was about 19. Yeah. So that's old for a Marine, by the way. That's very old. So I had spent about 8 years at that time with the DOD first. I'm sorry, did I interrupt something you were going to say?
No, that's okay. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, just trying to get a timeline here of a bit here in terms of your trajectory.
Yes.
Because it is quite interesting. And I have to say, you know, I was a consultant to JPL, and JPL is organized in a similar fashion to a government agency in some ways, although I think it's changed more recently. There were a lot of people that ended up having jobs and could basically clock in and clock out, and it never mattered whether they did anything. That's the way it looked. The inefficiency was amazing. And the old school way of filing and all these different kinds of things, of keeping documents, of et cetera, it was amazing. They also used the old phone system for the longest time. In fact, they still have it. They still do think there'll be a pulse. And in fact, there may be one. We're going to go to a break here, and we'll be right back. Okay, and with Douglas Dietrich. Thank you. Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and we are talking to Douglas Dietrich. Okay, Douglas, right before the break, I was talking to you about, just sort of comparing notes in terms of government jobs, and I do understand where you're coming from with all of that. However, what I want to do is, I believe, and there's a couple things. Michael Aquino, you said, you went to work as an assistant to him,
I was assigned liaison responsibilities because he had to use the library resources to access many of the medieval texts, which he got on an international level. When I was speaking about the security clearances, the reason I need to clarify that is because unlike just some general who had high-level security clearances domestically, Michael Aquino was on second men to NATO, as well as being a member of the World Affairs Council. So he had a very rare level of security clearance. Indeed, he had international level security clearances. That meant that he had security clearances which crossed international boundaries through North Atlantic Treaty Organization member states. And as a result, he was taking advantage of this to access museums and universities, not only in the United States, but also in the United Kingdom and their Commonwealth, meaning at that time, South Africa and Australia, New Zealand, the Dominion of Canada, etc. And as a result, he would tell them that I need these old texts, and these texts were kept in refrigerated safes. Literally, they wouldn't even allow archaeologists or linguists to open or look at them. They would try their best to try and scan the pages electronically and have everyone review them through something like that. Many of the pages literally could not be opened without destroying the text itself because some of them had been written originally in human blood or bound in human skin. As a result, the pages would no longer open. They had stuck or just become like solid chunks of rock. But the power in such cases was supposedly sourcing from the text itself as opposed to reading what was within it. But just handling these texts would risk their disintegration. So it took him saying that this was an international level security issue to get access to text after text in this sort of condition. And if any one of them powdered to dust in his hands, then you're talking about the disappearance of something that was literally priceless, something that was done by hand before the age of the printing press. And so nevertheless, they handed it over to this guy because he was able to declare international security as a rationale. And because they went to the library, were delivered by courier, like fine china, per force, they could not leave the library. And for that reason, he conducted all of his satanic rituals on site, the Presidio Military Base Library. As a result, I was witness to hundreds of satanic rituals. Majority of my life, I've worked night shift. Plenty of times I had to do overtime and do two shifts. Majority of my life, I've worked two shifts. And as a result, I would have usually a day shift and a night shift and sleep during what most people would term a swing shift. But in terms of the night jobs, when I was doing the incineration, because the incinerators going at full throttle would make the heat of the library unbearable during the daytime, we would run them during the night. While I was destroying documents is when I would be witness to his satanic rituals while the oven was going full throttle. And he loved it that way because he felt it made the library feel like the temperature of hell itself. And for all of his followers in his various covens, I had never seen a single participant who was beneath the rank of major. Basically, he was very elitist and dealt with only the highly educated. And so that was pretty much a general summation of the situation with Colonel Aquino. And,
okay, well, let me ask you this. Why did he let you be party to his rituals? Did he feel that you were...
He didn't have a choice. I was burning books and burning the documents and various other records in the incinerator room.
Did he just view you as an employee who was just on site?
Much more later on, because I was assigned liaison status to him in order to get these documents through the OCLC, the Online Cataloging and Library Cooperation Program, considered revolutionary at the time in terms of they said that they were going to make libraries without walls. Well, the reality was I never really used OCLC very much at all. What I mostly used in those days was the telephone, and it was a totally different world back then. And in terms of handling work on the telephone, it was far more faster, far more efficient than trying to do anything by Internet, because the Internet really was just beginning to gel, just beginning to form. As a matter of fact, those were the days truly before the Internet, and so truly before any functional Internet as people understand it today.
Well, I'm noticing that it says that at the Presidio, I don't know, a chaplain and his wife made charges against Michael Aquino and his wife Lilith as of trying to defraud the U.S. government of $3 million. Did you know anything about that?
To tell you the truth, that's not surprising to me because he was going through many, many lawsuits, many of which he instigated himself. To try and redeem his good name, so to speak. And a good example of that would be he sued for the removal of his name from the Army CID, the Criminal Investigations Division file, which was concerning the allegations of child abuse. And he lost. He also sued in the city of San Francisco. He lives in the same city with me. We're practically neighbors. We live within walking distance. Literally, he's only 6 to 8 square city blocks away from me.
So he's still alive.
Oh, very much so. And, in San Francisco, for instance, in the California courts, he basically instituted a legal action as a plaintiff, suing Electricity at that time, which is an early type of information distributor company, what we would call an internet business these days. But electricity was spelled ELECTRICITI, and that was Superior Court case of San Francisco 984751. So
well,
electricity.
Let me ask you something. Do you have a photographic memory?
No, I do not. I try to tell people that certain things just get branded in there that I try to forget. And then other things I try to remember, I forget them completely.
I was just curious because you're just quoting a case number, which is, you know, obviously seems to be a piece of minutia that only a photographic memory would remember.
Well, that's because when I worked as his liaison, there were certain things while handling his correspondence and his communications that I had to remember, and you deal with something often enough at the time that you're handling his correspondence or taking his calls, then years later, you'll remember that while forgetting your own Social Security number. That's probably the perversity of it. But,
okay.
Yeah, he was involved in any number of lawsuits. And for what it's worth, litigiously, this is something that I always have to emphasize, litigiously, he was never fingered in terms of being legally culpable for any of the child molestation scandals that took place. And as a matter of fact, the defrauding of the United States Army took place because he was working with, unless it's worded differently in that case, and it might be a different case, I believe the one that you're talking about might have to do with what he called the Imperial Stormtrooper program, where he was dealing with basically a kind of sorcerist warfare. He basically was doing for the Army a kind of permanent employment program for sorcerers, just as the Central Intelligence Agency had a welfare state for psychics through its remote viewing program. I'm not saying that to defame or to demean the abilities of people who have latent talents that we're only beginning to understand or harness. What I mean to say is that for the people who are administering these programs, that they tend to be a cash cow and a boondoggle that they usually don't, take advantage of in a constructive sense, but rather exploit. I hope that's clear. What I'm saying. But,
okay, well, that's a whole sort of can of worms, and it's a very interesting way that you phrase all of that. But, you know, and I'm afraid I have some more weightier matters to go into, but I wish I could follow each of these leads down to their sort of logical conclusion, but we just don't have the time in this conversation, although maybe we can have you back in the future to go into some of these things we miss.
I would really look forward to that. Thank you. And
awesome. Yeah. No, you sound very knowledgeable, and I am interested to know. It appears that Michael Aquino was a Rosicrucian, and I wonder if you, because you seem to have, this is where we sort of jog over to your bio, and I've also noticed that you had you were assigned as some kind of bodyguard. Is that a quasi? I mean, you called yourself a security, I don't know.
I prefer the term security enforcement agent, just like a professional private investigator would prefer that term over private eye or private dick.
Okay, so.
Both of which sound like body parts.
Security enforcement agent as opposed to bodyguard. Okay, but could you kind of clarify what you did as a security enforcement agent and sort of, because I noticed that later you had some physical issues with your lungs, which would have precluded doing any kind of physical, you know, type of thing. But were you a very strong young man who was able to be a bodyguard, or how did you get assigned that kind of thing?
No, thank you for asking to clarify that. And while we're talking about, we may as well clarify the physical injuries. And the reason why sometimes my voice starts bubbling over as if I've got a lot of phlegm in my lungs, that's because that's the case. Medically, I'm supposed to sleep with a CPAP, but I've neglected to do so just yet, because if I were to develop a dependency on such an instrument, eventually, when the science progresses enough medically, it was recommended that I wear a portable respirator, which means that when I'm conducting interviews like this, I'll come off sounding like Darth Vader or Cobra Commander, and I get enough comments in that direction already. So in order to prevent that, I try to keep my lungs as strong as possible and keep them functioning unassisted. But what had happened in terms of the dishonorable discharge, just to clarify that with people who are very into the military. First off, a dishonorable discharge is one of the rarest things in the world. There's almost nobody gets a dishonorable discharge. That's basically, there's less than honorable discharges, there's other than honorable discharges. They have so many things that they can do to avoid a dishonorable discharge, because that means they have to get basically a court together assembled with officers. So if somebody gets a dishonorable discharge, it's almost certainly a political thing that is of such importance that it's usually international in nature. So the important thing to remember about the United States Marine Corps is that they're not just fighting men, they're diplomats in uniform. It's the United States Marine Corps that guards the embassies worldwide. So in that sense, they represent the United States as an image. And as a result, they're highly sensitive to what happens with them internationally. And in the case of Operation Desert Storm, which lasted about 9 months, like childbirth, was shortly after we disembarked from our port of deployment. South of that was the city of Al-Jubail, and it was there on August 7th of 1990 during Operation Desert Shield, which was a build-up to Operation Desert Storm. That was the largest assemblage of Marines in the history of the United States. There have never been that many Marines ever in one place, because they usually fought in very small expeditionary units during World War I in Europe and on the islands in World War II. But this was an actual, quote-unquote, army of Marines, more appropriately, a task force. And there were several of them that were created ad hoc, out of sackcloth, so to speak, or whole cloth, just to deal with the situation. And but in terms of what had happened with Al-Jubail, there was a girls' dormitory caught fire, and unfortunately a Mutawwa'in unit was nearby. Mutawwa'in, just to clarify this, are Saudi religious police, and they're very similar to the Inquisition of the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages. They're not regular, but all police in the House of Saud throughout Southwest Asia and much of the world carry machine guns, not like police in the United States. The Mutawwa'in also are issued whips, so that they can whip any young lady who they find who's wearing lipstick or they feel is acting in a self-provocative manner. So what happened was, when this girl's dormitory caught fire, then they began to machine gun the girls that were running out because they were exiting the dormitory without their veils. And I attacked them. One of my own men attacked me before I could take too many of them down. And I was not wearing my helmet at the time. I woke up with a concussion in the hospital, and I was facing a JAG, a Judge Advocate General, who told me I was going to be spending an enormous amount of time in jail. And the reason why was because the House of Saud was so incensed at my interfering with the Mutawwa'in as they were putting down what they interpreted to be a spontaneous episode of feminine self-display, that they were threatening to expel the United States Expeditionary Forces from the House of Saud. Now, that would have, of course, destroyed all preparations for Gulf War II, where Gulf War I was Iran-Iraq, 1980 through 1988. And as a result, I, in order to appease the House of Saud, was dishonorably discharged with a court-martial. And that's why they call it a court-martial. A court has to be convened. And they were satisfied enough with that in the House of Saud. I was ultimately given that discharge, however, after Operation Desert Storm. They needed too many warm bodies at the time. And as a result, they stripped me down by a stripe, and I was sent back, instead of as a corporal, instead as a lance corporal in charge of a fire team. Then we went through the minefields towards the direction of Kamisaya, where there's an actual misprint, and these things on the biography get corrected as I find out updates or are corrected by other servicemen. As Marines, we assumed it was the Seabees blowing the canisters of toxic chemicals at Kamisaya. It turned out it was the Army Corps of Engineers. So all credit to the Army Corps of Engineers for their own suffering in this regard. But the problem was that these chemical dump sites, which had been used to, they were fertilizer chemicals. They were they were put together in a specific composition to create toxic nerve agents, specifically cyclosamine nerve gas. And they were deployed against the Kurds during Saddam Hussein's repression of the Kurdish peoples. So they were a genocidal-level nerve agent, and what the United States wanted was to destroy all of these dump sites in order to prevent the receipts, tracing it all back to Halliburton and America's chemical industries. And as a result, when those things were blown, we were all exposed to genocidal-level nerve agents, because despite our MOP gear, which is chemical warfare agents that we were trained, we were trained to basically inject atropine with exposure to the nerve agents, but we shouldn't have been exposed to them in the first place if we were wearing our mop gear, our chemical warfare gear. The problem is it's charcoal lined. Nothing is meant to get in, so you don't get contaminated. The end result is if you're wearing that in the desert where it's over 100 degrees already, you're losing 15 to 17 pounds of water weight in as many minutes. We had men dropping at dehydration, and we had a choice of either dying wearing this mop gear or dying without it. So we chose to die without it. We just were removing all of our...
Oh, wow, yes. I think I've heard some of this. Now, I want to actually slow you down 1 second here because you're talking about this nerve agent and you're talking about that it was manufactured by Halliburton. I'm just curious, did you know all of this when you were there at that time, or did you find this out later?
I had many suspicions. See, this is probably the biggest question that they had about me in the Marine Corps was I went in as an enlisted man as opposed to an officer. One of those things was I never wanted to intimidate my father. My father had been an enlisted man all of his life. I didn't like officers. I had a very, very low opinion of officers, still do for the most part, in the U.S. military. And this could be understood by the kind of officers that I saw dealing with Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, with all the officers that were dealing with DeltaNet. And DeltaNet was an offshoot of DARPANET. And we can go into this in greater detail later, but basically DeltaNet in particular was notorious within the Department of Defense for basically being used to circulate child pornography. So with this kind of impression that I had of officers, the kind of I could go on for hours as to my detestation in general for the officers class of the United States of mostly any service. The service that I had the least amount of disrespect for was the Marines for a number of different reasons, and I thought that it would be a good place to go into to get military experience so I could ultimately employ myself within private security. Now, as a result, about once a year, because of exposure to cyclothyrene nerve toxins, I began to suffer spontaneous pneumothoraxes. Now, every time I would suffer a spontaneous pneumothorax, I'd be on an intubator. I'd be intubated for almost a month, sometimes over a month, and each time I would lose about 3 to 5 pounds of muscle mass that I would never regain. So I'm certainly 50 pounds lighter than I ever was before, originally about 40 pounds lighter, but over the years I've just atrophied quite a bit. And yes, you would think that that would prevent someone from doing particularly physical work in security enforcement, but there's two factors here. Security enforcement, it's not like I'm a ninja. I'm not a commando. I'm not going around picking people up and punching them through walls. Basically, the job of most people with private security enforcement is that you're either handling a weapon, which is doesn't take that much energy, and or you're taking a bullet. Really, if you do have bodyguard status, and it's a term that I personally loathe, but I did serve bodyguard status many times, your primary job is just to take a bullet. There is nothing you can really do to prevent an assassin who wants to take somebody down from taking them down other than to get in the way. That is what every Secret Service man who's guarding the executive office knows deep down in his heart. The reason he's there, if he's going to do his job correctly, what he's being paid for is ultimately when he gets somebody pointing a bullet at his man, he jumps in front of him. That's what your job is. So that's not
so you had to have special training for that, I assume, right?
Yeah, I went through training. Keep in mind that this happened over a decade, my gradual atrophying through the spontaneous pneumothoraxes. They were happening on average about once every 1.5 years, and I was still able to keep up with the majority of lighter-level physical training. Please keep in mind these were private contracts. And they're not like in a government military program where somebody is training to be a special forces operative. I'm not somebody who is going towards endurance running. I'm not hefting heavy packs. So because it's all privately contracted, there's no review boards. I'm not going through any physical tests that would normally be done to make sure somebody qualifies. I'm not training to be an Olympian. So I was quite able to maintain private contracts. And just to put this into perspective, please, anyone can take a look at some of these people working for Blackwater and working for the various other security enforcement agencies or mercenary pimp groups that are out there in the world around us. And have you ever seen these guys? They got beards. They got guts. These people
yes,
look like, you know,
them,
they look like, you know, Deputy Dog or these county sheriffs. And
right.
I was in far better shape than these yahoos that I see parading around working for these private security groups. Just I hope that puts it in some perspective.
Yes,
I wouldn't be
yes.
doing it today. I mean, these days I'm lucky if I can get out of bed. But yeah, for that 10 years following that initial cyclosarine exposure, yeah, I was able to pull it.
Okay. And so at that point, you that was before. Well, let me make sure I'm getting this chronology right again. Just I have kind of a purpose behind my wanting to get a chronology here. You basically went into the Marines, then you got a dishonorable discharge for the reasons you stated, which are rather political in nature. And then, and you actually did something, an act of valor, what I would call an act of valor, right?
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. Unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a total failure in every regard. 289 girls died that day. Though in the English-speaking magazines that they publish for the rest of the world, they say majority of them survived. I know for a fact that's not the case because the Arabic said otherwise.
Right. And by the way, you do speak a bit of Arabic, isn't that right?
A little bit, less and less every day. Mostly a smattering of languages that I picked up on security enforcement contracts. That bit of Arabic comes from the Marine Corps, where I learned to respect the beauty of the language, if not the horror of the culture. But I will definitely say that when you don't use it, you lose it. So I try to keep my mind as occupied as much as possible, because there is also a danger. Obviously, I got enough of the cyclosarine nerve gas, where I've got no less than 7 chest tube sites along my rib cage. And as a result, that's a lot of gas. That's a lot of exposure. What ultimately happened was it all stopped the spontaneous pneumothoraxes, the lung collapses. They would ultimately have killed me. What happened was UCSF did an experimental surgery where they went into my torso and they stapled my lungs to my rib cage. And now that my lungs are stapled to my rib cage, the spontaneous pneumothoraxes have stopped. There's still a high percentage of chance that they will collapse again in the future, at which point they can do nothing for it. And at that point, I'm going to die. But as a result, that was one of the reasons why I also had a devil-may-care attitude about the high-risk, high-pay security contracts, was because I was given a terminal diagnosis. Before that surgery came along, MDs just told me, you're going to die. And they just said, There's no hope for you. Basically, you're going to die drowning in your own waste tissues in terms of your lung production of mucus and various other things that were going on. As a matter of fact, with my first spontaneous pneumothorax, I came into the hospital clinically dead. They had to use the paddles and everything. I was blue in the face. And what kills a person when they're usually shot or stabbed, oftentimes is not. It's not the stab wound or the bullet wound. It's all that just mucus and effluvia that begins to fill the chest cavity and presses against the heart and envelops it. That was what was happening to me. And then they gave me some young MD who was just training to become a doctor. He shoved in the chest tube so hard he collapsed the other lung. So
incredible.
That was it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, I'm sorry for your health problems, which seem to be rather extensive, and you sound full of life in spite of that, I must say.
Thank you.
So just to get down back to this sort of saga that is your life, it looks like, I can't believe we're at the top of the hour again. We have a short break here, and when I come back, hopefully we can kind of get into some more of grittier stuff in terms of your philosophies, etc.
Thank you.
Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and we are talking to Douglas Dietrich. Douglas, okay, I'm going to try to sort of skip ahead here because we don't have all the time in the world, and I know there are a lot of people that may want to be asking you questions. And let me just say right off the bat that we do have a chat room that's part of our radio show, and we also have the ability for people to call in. Now, if you are on the website for Freedom Slips, which I assume you are, there should be a phone number there to call in. And they handle the phone calls. I guess they put me on with you when we kind of give them the go ahead. So it's kind of an interesting process. But, the other side of that is that we do have a chat room. You can go to Project Camelot, portal.com or projectcamelot.org, and that takes you to the same place. Scroll down to the radio show icon and you'll find a link there that says live chat during the show. And, that is where you can sort of sign in and then ask questions. If you do have questions, please put them in all caps. It helps me to find them more easily. So, Douglas, at this point, first of all, you actually ended up going into the, or at least being recruited somehow, into the San Francisco Police Department, right?
Yeah, what I did was I attended the Peace Officer Standard Training and graduated from the San Francisco Police Academy. I was in for a very short period of time. And like the military, it's a paramilitary unit. They want you in before for a full 180 days before you're considered qualified enough where you would receive benefits when you're injured. Unfortunately, while I was in the academy, they allowed somebody in who had chicken pox. He had caught it from his infant son. He went on to become a San Francisco County Sheriff. And this individual, of course, I told the sergeant in the academy that you shouldn't let that individual back in here. He had open running sores all over his face like he had been, he looked like a zombie from one of the horror films. And I said, you know, unknown to most people, very few Asians are exposed to chickenpox when they're young. It's one of those diseases that really doesn't manifest that much in Asia. And I was born in Taiwan, and I told them I had never been exposed to chickenpox before. And, oh, you know, of course, the usual macho response was, well, if you're not copulating with him, you're not going to get it. Well, of course, I caught it just by being in the same room with this idiot. And I wound up going deaf in my right ear. So it winds up, it's very dangerous for adults, especially male adults. I wound up with my right ear's audio nerves being totally pretty much killed. I was much luckier than another cadet who contracted it from this moron, and that cadet died because it got into his trachea, and they were unable to tracheotomize him in time, and he choked on chicken pox.
Incredible.
So that's what happened with that. I was in for a very short period of time, but it was another feather in my cap that I was able to use to my advantage for security enforcement contracts.
I see that. And then eventually it says at the height of the Balkan War, the third Balkan War, you were, I guess, involved in, what was it, guarding, I don't know, you had an affair with a Balkan and then you got involved in the Serbian struggle. Is there anything, somehow you ended up involved in Waco as well?
Yeah, well, that was my ex-girlfriend, and I feel free to give her first name because first name was Svetlana. Short name for that is Seca. Every girl in the Balkans, especially in Serbia, is named Svetlana, so no one is going to find her on basis of that. So, but at any rate, Svetlana was a follower of Vernon Howell back when he was doing rock bands. Before he became the second incarnation of the Christ, per his cosmology. And I don't accept his cosmology, but basically what had happened was, what a lot of people are unfamiliar with is the fact that she was a Seventh-day Adventist, and that's where the term Branch Davidian, of which David Koresh was the, of course, the Messiah for Branch Davidian. And the reason they got the term Branch Davidian was they branched off from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, concentration-wise, the highest amount of concentrated Seventh-day Adventists in the world is in Vojvodina, which is a region of the nation of Serbia. So it's to them, for Seventh-day Adventists, what the state of Utah is for Mormons in the United States.
I see.
Yeah, and so what a lot of people don't realize is because of this, Branch Davidian picked up by a lot of Yugoslav followers. There were followers there from Australia and other Commonwealth nations as well, South Africa and New Zealand. But what people don't realize is the compound that David Koresh was running was an international compound. And she had actually been en route to Waco, Texas to become part of the compound and to catch up with her old lover, Vernon Howell, also known as David Koresh, when the whole siege went down. And she was not allowed through the siege lines at that point when everything froze. And so she watched in horror while people that she knew, including some relatives, died, were burned alive.
Okay, but let me just ask you, did you have any sort of inside information about, because it kind of, it appears that you might have, in regard to the fact that what really went down there, were you aware of, for example, the mind control aspect of it?
You know, interestingly enough, I was not dealing so much with that. What I was dealing with was the comparison that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was consulting with the military. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that drove, Timothy McVeigh over the edge, was the fact that it was one of his Gulf War era surplus Abrams Bradley fighting vehicle, military, he was convinced that his Bradley fighting vehicle, he was one of the few men who got it to work. Just to put this into perspective for you, no one in the entire Gulf War, unless you're part of some special operations unit deep behind the lines, unless you were conducting airstrikes from a helicopter or from a plane or bombarding off the shore from a battleship, which literally there was a battleship doing bombardment during Operation Desert Storm. There's no single soldier or Marine, except a few. Battle of Alcafia, about 20 Marines died. There was a hero, Colonel Admire, who led Task Force Taro, which I became a part of. That's not that I was part of any special unit at all. That was an enormous task force. He was put in charge of it because of his experience with the Battle of Alcafia. But at any rate, in terms of just a few select incidents in the war, nobody killed the enemy face-to-face in Gulf War II, other than Timothy McVeigh. He's one of the few who, as a regular grunt, a regular soldier, was able to get his Bradley fighting vehicle working to the point, because they were notorious for breaking down, they were notorious for not working at all, they were a boondoggle for the defense contractors. He got it working, and he killed somebody with it during the war. He was convinced he saw his Bradley fighting vehicle being used as surplus when they went to mow down the Branch Davidian compound. And that's one of the things that pushed him over the edge and radicalized him, because they were using a lot of military-grade equipment and so-called tear gas. It was really a war nerve agent. It was outlawed for use of tear gas in every nation in the world, including the United States. But they used it anyway. Highly flammable. It's one of the reasons.
But there were also a tremendous number of children there, wasn't there?
More so than they count. Many fetuses spontaneously aborted because of the heat of the flames. The heat of the flames that were generated were so intense that the Branch Davidian flag, which was a Star of David, by the way, that was atop that flagpole, literally spontaneously burst into flames because all the heat being generated from the compound was so intense. And after that, the ATF ran up their own flag like this was a military invasion. So the way that I was exposed to the Branch Davidian compound was mostly through security enforcement contracts. I got to see some footage most people didn't see. One example of that footage was there is an ATF agent. You always see these shots coming out of the compound and the agent rolling down, you know, the roof of the compound. That's like a famous shot. Well, that shot has several moments of footage before you see that. And what you see is several ATF agents entering, then the agent behind them pulls out a grenade, throws it in, and frags them. And basically, while they're dying, they're firing back up at him through the roof, and those bullets are coming up through the roof. Then he rolls down. That is how that went down. He fragged those agents under orders so that they could say somebody was killed and they could start firing on the compound. That was the conclusion I drew by what I saw. That is what I saw that would be inside information dealing with the BATF and Waco, as opposed to, say, mind control aspects of that situation at that time. But okay, in terms of Svetlana with her personal connections, it was through this conversation regarding what had happened that her and I struck it up, developed a relationship, and then later on I became interested in the Balkans and ultimately in private mercenary work my way up to the Balkans, where I was involved later on in the Third Balkan War in the aftermath. So that was how that essentially got established. So please go on.
I didn't know. Did you have something you wanted to say right there? Because then I'll ask a question after that.
Oh, no, please ask the question. I think it's far better to get things out.
Okay, well, you were, it looks like you were assigned to, I don't know, were you assigned, it's unclear from the bio. Were you assigned in San Francisco for guarding this prince and princess of Yugoslavia?
Yes, when they were visiting, as a matter of fact. The prince and princess of Yugoslavia are of the Karađorđević dynasty, and they were in exile in England. I believe they're still in London because that's to my knowledge. I haven't really followed up on it. So this, if anything that I say dates me, then that's fine. Keep in mind, once I'm done with a contract or something like that, there are many things that I don't follow up again for decades. And if anything, that helps validate what I'm saying. But the point is that the reason they were called prince and princess, even though they were in their 50s and 60s, was because they were never coronated as king and queen, because essentially the original dynasty for the king and queen of Yugoslavia reestablished itself in London as a government in exile during the Second World War. So when they reestablished themselves there, they were unable to return to their nation to have a formal coronation for the prince and princess, so they grew up their entire lives, even into their 50s and 60s, as prince and princess. And she actually is Macedonian, and then he is Serbian, the man who would be king of Yugoslavia. But at any rate, yes, I worked with them, basically guarding them while they were in San Francisco because I spoke perfect English. I had the Serbian connections, and then I did some work in the Balkans, but that was only tenuously connected with the royal dynasty itself. But it was in order to be recognized as a guard to the heirs of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. That's one of the reasons why I formally converted to Byzantine Orthodoxy. They would not accept a security guard on behalf of a Byzantine Orthodox prince and princess who was not a member of the church. So for professional reasons, I became a member of the Byzantine Orthodox Church. So formally, I am a Byzantine Orthodox Christian.
Okay, that's interesting. First of all, let me ask you, just in terms of your genetic heritage, are you what is your sort of bloodline? Are you part? I'm sorry, I don't know.
Oh, my mother. Well, I was born in Taiwan, which was the Nationalist Republic of China as reestablished on the island of Taiwan. So, in terms of nationality, I am literally Chinese. But in terms of the, I also have, the citizenship of the United States, of course. I'm a U.S. citizen because my father was an American serviceman. I was born overseas, but I was born a naturalized citizen per force of his being a U.S. serviceman, active duty at the moment that I was conceived. So,
in terms of their bloodline, are they both Chinese?
I'll clarify that now. My mother was born in Tokyo. She is half Chinese, half Japanese. I always emphasize this because there's this wretched stereotype in the United States of the Japanese as pathological racists. And my mother was born in Tokyo well before World War II in 1923, and her father was Chinese, and her mother was Japanese. So it was a Chinese man who took a Japanese bride in the capital city of Japan in Tokyo in 1923. So any myths about Japanese racism, I hope, are put to rest with that. And she wound up living most of her life in Taiwan, which was part of Japan, an integral part of Japan, at that period of time for many years, from 1895 to 1945. Yes, and as much part of Japan as Okinawa or Korea, the Korean Peninsula, or at that time in history. And
then what was your father?
Father was Caucasian, and he was basically, as you can tell by the last name, primarily of German descent, but also some other European bloodlines. His mother was more Irish, and some Native American bloodstream, which came out very predominantly as a recessive gene in my sister and myself, which was one of the reasons why he had to move to San Francisco away from his own family in upstate New York. He was born and grew up in the company town, Kodak company town of Rochester, New York, and moved to San Francisco to get as far away as possible from his family because of the horrible racism that was displayed both by his family and the community towards his ethnic wife and both of his children, my sister and myself.
Okay, when you said Native American, your father had Native American blood, is what you're saying?
Yes, he had about a quarter Native American blood, 25%. I myself have about 1/8 Native American blood as a result.
Okay, and would you find the reason, you know, I'm going down this road, I don't even know if you know anything about Camelot, but obviously we've interviewed a number of sort of what you might call victims of MKUltra. That's one way of putting it. Super soldiers is another. you know, people who've been chosen by the military at a young age and been tracked. And I'm just wondering if you feel that you were given a certain amount of psychic ability based on your heritage at all.
Well, it's an interesting point. I know that many people in the Native American original peoples community feel that they are often recruited for these special projects because of inherent abilities. I myself have never felt that way, but I'm certain that I was monitored at various times. That's just undeniable because as a military dependent, I was given full access to the Letterman Army Medical Center. So the Letterman Army Medical Center trained the vast majority of the U.S. Army doctors in the United States. Letterman Army Medical Center was huge. It was also notorious for all kinds of experimentation on prisoners who were volunteering for shortened sentences, relief of death sentences, etc., if they would undergo various experiments at Letterman Army Medical Center, also famous for experiments on dogs and other animals. So it was a very dark and dire place in many, many respects. And I spent an enormous amount of time in Letterman Army Medical Center because of the illnesses I had suffered as a child just growing up in the Tenderloin of San Francisco.
I see.
Yeah, and there's no way to describe how filthy that area of the city is and just the kind of horrors we were exposed to. The best way to place it is that when I first, got romantically involved with that State Department identified Sandinista. Hate to remember her as such, but that's, you know, was to impact my career so profoundly, forever what gets branded in my mind along with, you know, whatever romantic interest I had in her at the time. When I went down to Nicaragua, the capital city of Managua, in the middle of the Civil War, the first thing that struck me was how safe I felt, how wholesome the environment was, and how utterly, idyllic it was like Eden compared to the Tenderloin of San Francisco. I mean, I have never felt so. It was like just breathing fresh oxygen for the first time in my life. Yeah, that's how bad the Tenderloin district of San Francisco was. Just an endless sea of horrors in that environment. But it was through that environment, of course, I was so familiar with it that I also had my connections into the private security enforcement business. It's all these connections that one develops in life. Yeah, that's how I got involved.
Well, okay, I'm sorry, you know, to interrupt you here, and I'm going to try to go to some questions. I know that you've got, you know, a lot more than, your website is actually not about your life, right?
No, not really. No, the website is basically, website's very Spartan, very basic. It's simply about topics that I'm available to speak for, but the reason I bring up aspects of my life is to show people that I'm qualified, and just to drive this home for people, because they, these days, in the baby boomer generation, Americans, whether they want to accept this or not, were programmed by their government and society to worship the bomb. Everything was the bomb. The bomb was the alpha and omega. It could end the world. And these days, with people growing up these days, it's the internet. And there seems to be this almost mystical belief, bordering on religious, that whatever's happening in the world or whatever happened in history, somehow you're going to find it on the net. And I'm here to tell you, nothing could be further from the truth. The first thing, long before the internet, there was DARPANET, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency Net. And in terms of that, very little was entered. This is the weakest link in the chain of information distribution, is the human entry, human data entry. And if some human doesn't enter that data, it's not going to wind up on the net. Now, most of what's on DARPANET, just volumes and volumes, reams and reams, mountains of information from DARPANET will never make it to the internet. And there's plenty that I was doing as a documents destruction specialist that never made it onto DARPANET. And to give you an example, I mean, the other day when I was speaking on radio, I was talking about the Vietnam Memorial Wall. Well, again, a very distant relative of mine, same family last name from Chinese, Lin, Maya Ying Lin, designed that Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. Without her, there would be no Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. It wasn't the U.S. government that provided that. And whenever I say something like 20,000 officers got fragged in Vietnam, then I have all of these, even Vietnam veterans, some of them, until they wake up will roll on the floor laughing. All the wannabe military armchair historians are cussing me out, and they're saying, oh, there's only 50,000 names on the wall. Well, let me put that into perspective for you. You know, lately I was talking, the last time I checked on the wall was about the 1990s, and there was only one woman's name on the wall. It was brought to my attention that there are eight. Still far, far less than the amount of women who died in Vietnam. Because of my incineration of documents, I can tell you that at least 66 American women died in Vietnam. Army Nurse Corps, Air Force Nurse Corps. They were all listed as corpsmen so that they could continue to make the claim there were no women in Vietnam. They would just say, oh, the corpsmen. Agency for International Development, Army Special Services, Central Intelligence Agency, American Red Cross, Catholic Relief Services, journalists, missionaries, Operation Baby Lift. We had 38 women die trying to bring Amerasian kids out of Vietnam into the United States. None of their names are on the wall. And I'll tell you something. With all the documents I fed into those furnaces, I can tell you with 66 women going into the furnaces who died in Vietnam, many of them were raped and murdered by American troops. So you've got the situation where they never want their names on the wall. So how much of a percentage is that? If you've got eight as opposed to 66 who died in Vietnam, eight are on that wall. Think about what it is for the men. You've got 50,000 names on the wall. What they're telling you is from the first OSS officer died in 1945 in Vietnam. And we were involved in Vietnam from 1945 to 1975. Now, during that period of time, at the height of that war, you had 600,000 troops in 1968 Vietnam. That's over 500,000 troops. You divide that by just a modicum of the Vietnam War, which was 30 years. You divide that by just a modicum or multiply it, you've got like, what, 6 million troops in Vietnam at least. And they're telling you by that wall, 50,000 names, that 0.01% of them died. That's just impossible. There's no way. You've got millions and millions of men, and the casualty rates they had, that you had a casualty rate, a fatality rate of 0.01%. You've got to have at least 10%. That would be 500,000 names should be on that effing wall. And
okay,
so,
I see. This is an example of the kind of, about this.
Yeah, of information, you know, people think they know. And I'm telling you that there's so much you're never going to find on the internet. And as someone who's running the ovens, I can tell you that. It's just important for me to get that out. I hope you understand, Ms. Cassidy.
No, no problem. And I appreciate that. I appreciate your passion for that. Needless to say, it actually sounds like you really do have some accurate information there, and people should pay attention. Okay. You have these, I don't know, you've got what appears to be, if I can tell by looking at your site, two books. I don't know if Satan's Crusaders is a book, right?
Oh, no. Well, thank you very much for bringing that up. Basically, what we have at the moment are two DVDs that we put into a set, and we're discontinuing our DVD package as soon as all of our current run of DVD sets are gone, because we're going to take the information that's within those DVDs and release them in a textual format. And so the DVDs are on sale at two for the price of one. So be kind enough to go to the website and investigate that, and that will help support me. Obviously, I don't get those government checks anymore. And in terms of the personal appearances where these books will be released, we will be releasing my first book, The Reality of the Red Undead, The Untold True Story of the Supernatural Soviets, which discusses the Soviet attempts to breed various subspecies of humanity for the purposes of the military expansion of what they deem to be scientific socialist progress. And that will be released at the Conspiracy Con, where we certainly hope to see you. Yes,
yes.
And I would love to meet you there personally. I would
be great. Yeah,
very
absolutely.
Much looking forward to that. And that will be the first 3 days of June at the Santa Clara Marriott, Friday night, June 1st, and then Saturday, June 2nd, and Sunday, June 3rd. And just check up my website for the banner on that, or conspiracycon.com. But I certainly invite you to any of the other two places where I'll be speaking in the closer future, the 2012 summit at the Trinity United Methodist Church in Mountain View in Northern California. And that'll be Saturday, May 12th of this year. And also, of course, the Super Soldier program is something that I very much look forward and anticipate delivering the opening presentation on, the satanic secrets behind the Super Soldier program, American Demonolatry in the U.S. Criminal State. This is the first event of its its kind ever. And the Super Soldier Summit number one will be held in California's Marin County. But to maintain a modicum of personal security for all of our speakers and any attendees, the precise location of the venue will not be disclosed, excepting to those who purchase tickets. So you can check the supersoldiersummit.com. Or again, everything is on my website, and my website itself is www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is spelled either like the famous actress Marlena Dietrich, her family name and mine, or just put the words diet and rich together. So D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. So douglasdietrich.com, and hopefully you'll get, you know, the information you need regarding this. And
okay,
thank you.
Well, very good. Yes, absolutely. And so we have about a half hour left. I know we're going to go to a break shortly here. You know, I am very fascinated by your investigations, and I wanted to know more about your sort of involvement with the Super Soldier story, and it looks like you came to it by way of your investigations into the Soviets. Is that right?
No, thank you for bringing that up. That actually is not the case.
We come back, sorry, yeah. There's a break right here, and when we come back, you can answer that question. I'd be very interested to hear your answer.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. The question that I had asked you, and I assume you remember the question. If not, I can repeat it.
Oh, no, I believe it was the super soldier phenomena, how I ran into it. Was it through the investigations into the Soviet attempts to breed subspecies of humanity?
Yes.
And, it was that. That was not the case at all. That was actually documents that a good part of the book has to deal with documents that were brought out of Eastern Europe, wound up in the hands of the CIA through dissidents and journalists, mostly sourcing out of Prague. And the CIA just translated a lot of those documents, turned it over to the NATO High Command. That's how they wound up in the U.S. military, bailiwick, and then they were slated for document destruction. So that forms a good deal of the materials I use for the book, as well as translated documents from Defense Intelligence Agency concerning various things concerning the Indo-Pakistani conflicts that directly involved communist China and its war with the Soviet Union. It had a very huge border war with the Soviet Union that went on for 10 years that Americans are unfortunately, in the most part, entirely unaware of. But so that's where that book comes from. But in terms of the Super Soldier program itself, let me put it in this perspective. Every single American soldier in Europe who was involved with the Third Army, particularly the armored divisions of the Third Army in Western Europe during World War II, in one way or another, their lives were either impacted or somehow intertwined tangentially or inextricably with General George S. Patton. And in terms of the Deutsche Afrika Korps, almost every single Soldaten or Trupp who was involved with the Afrika Korps in North Africa had his life in one way or another impacted or inexplicably linked with Field Marshal Ivan Rohner. And in terms of the super soldiers who were victims of MKUltra, Project Monarch, various MyLab, and in this case I mean military intelligence labs as opposed to MyLab as in military abductions. They're different acronyms. But just like PSYOPS, PSYOPS is different from PSYOPS, PSIOPS, meaning psionic operations such as remote viewing, as opposed to PSYOPS, which means attempts to manipulate media or public opinion, etc., amongst many other aspects of PSYOPS. But in terms of the super soldiers, in one way or another, every single one of them, United Kingdom or United States, has had their lives impacted by Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino. And so that,
really?
Yes, was how I was exposed to that or aspects of it. That was something that even as his liaison and handling his correspondence and handling much of his communications, most of that was being handled through the Presidio Military Base Library for obvious reasons. So there's aspects of what he did outside of that milieu which we can only learn through other super soldiers, or in a very real sense, a more appropriate term for them would be super victims, who were basically exposed to what he was involved with in the United Kingdom. And he was in the United Kingdom. He was in Germany and various other European countries in and out of his NATO responsibilities. So Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino's name comes up again and again.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I want to interrupt you here and ask you about the San Francisco-based MK Ultra program that went on during, I think it was the 60s, basically, that then became more or less it's sort of, well, at least there are some files that are in the public domain at this time, right?
I believe so, yes. I would
you should be aware
of
that. Yeah, well, there are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the reason I'm bringing that up is do you happen to know if he was also involved in that?
Not from my understanding, because this is where he was often frustrated, was because it's very difficult for a lot of people to understand, but the Central Intelligence Agency was formed specifically, originally, so that they wouldn't have to turn over any of the information and fragments and aspects of the Roswell atrocity to the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover was demanding them, and rather than turn it over to him, they formed the CIA in 1947, very shortly after the Roswell atrocity. And what they did was they got the Central Intelligence Agency was formed primarily. Its original function, which was not at all similar to the OSS, which preceded it. People think that there was an OSS, then there was a straight line to the CIA. That wasn't the case. The U.S. Army had an enormous part, played an enormous part in creating the CIA, and was totally separate from the OSS in the sense that the OSS was more of an active espionage agency working behind the lines to impact what was going on in other countries, whereas the CIA was more of a bureaucracy that shuffled papers like a champ. And the CIA was originally created to oversee Tonopah Army Airfield. Tonopah Army Airfield became CIA designated Area 51. So the Army created the CIA, and then that's why the CIA worked hand in glove with the Army Special Forces in particular in the Indochina conflict. And Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino was very much a product of the Vietnam era. And in terms of that, he had to, as an Army man, have enormous dealings with the Central Intelligence Agency. He was very frustrated by the fact that they did not respect their Army foundations and were very much operating oftentimes independently of the United States Army. So he
my understanding is that there was another way that they were formed. I'm not sure, but my understanding is that James Jesus Angleton had a lot more to do with the formation of the CIA than what you're alluding to.
Well, keep in mind, the documents that I deal with give me a perspective that's very different from what a lot of people are accessing through either Freedom of Information or perhaps other people who are insiders who are giving their perspective on it. But I can tell you the Army foundations of the CIA were indeed very heavy. And but I'll tell you how heavy they were because the CIA was conducting a lot of mind control programs independently of the Army, weren't really cooperating in a lot of information exchange, various other occult programs they were dealing with that we could go into either on the show or another one. But Colonel Aquino said he would get his vengeance. He was grooming somebody. And just recently, we had U.S. Army General David Petraeus take over the Central Intelligence Agency. So
right.
Colonel Aquino has had his machinations come to fruition, and he is still a consultant. He's still a consultant to the U.S. Army in retirement, as so many retired high officers are. And he always had the power of any high-ranking general. Don't ever let his low rank, comparatively speaking, fool you, because like a general in wartime, or a colonel in wartime, excuse me, can wind up commanding entire force units or armies in the field in place of a general when there's no general around. He was respected because he knew the rituals to several occult phenomena and actions that the generals had to refer to him for. It would be like a military doctor. A doctor's orders medically would supersede that of a general's. So even if that doctor were a lieutenant. So it was
okay,
the same
but
way
you're saying Michael Aquino was this person.
Well, he was a person who had an enormous amount of power when it came to many occult phenomena, but he was very frustrated in terms of some of the things the CIA was doing because the Army was not being given full and open access. He felt that someday he would change that by holding an Army junta or coup that would overtake the CIA. That's obviously happened. At this point in history, the CIA has been conquered by the United States Army.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. One thing which you may be familiar with is Project Stargate, which was run by Major General Albert Stumblebean, who I believe was an Army officer.
That may be the case. You know, keep
and
in
I
mind,
believe that program was sort of part of the Army initially.
Probably was. I'm not doubting that. I don't know too much about Project Stargate, and that would be for someone else.
You know, I don't have the documentation in front of me. This is, I'm going by memory, but this is my understanding. I remember there being a very strong Army element to Project Stargate when it initially was established. And eventually it came out under the CIA, I realized, but I for some reason think that it had some kind of
Army influence. Yeah, that makes sense because of the history that I've just outlined. But at the same time, with all of the volumes of information that I was dealing with, obviously I'm not going to know everything. And there's plenty way out of my league. There's plenty that was above my pay grade, I assure you. That would be one of them. Yeah, I can't speak to Project Stargate. Okay. I've heard of it, but, you know.
I see. Okay. Well, at this point, though, in terms of the way you're looking at this overall sort of program and Michael Aquino's, we seem to have come full circle from the beginning of the interview here today to his name again, and the occult references, have you been able to sort of connect the dots such that you understand maybe the role of the Vatican, the occult, and, Satanism certainly in the military?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I went so far as to publish and promote the DVD, Satan's Crusaders, Coming of Age in the Devil's Presidio Playground. I do hope people avail themselves of that so they understand just how far impacted the U.S. Army in particular is by Satanism. Please keep in mind, this is the only army in the history of mankind that has ever officially recognized a satanic chaplaincy. That really ought to tell us all something. And so it had to have an enormous, and it did have an enormous satanic influence before it was officially recognized. So that means throughout the Second World War, there was an enormous amount of satanic influence, and then they simply made it legitimate. They legitimated it by offering a satanic chaplaincy. And by the way, Colonel Aquino is still, as far as I understand it, the satanic chaplain to the U.S. Army, but he works in consultation. And until the day he dies, it would be like the Pope. Basically, until he dies, then another heir apparent will not be brought to the fore. But so it's still him, essentially, even though he's not in service. So,
incredible. That's just wild. And I'm sure our listeners will be fascinated by that. And I wish we had more time to go into all of this stuff. What I'd like to do is, I don't know if they can hear me, but we could take some phone calls here. If there are some people that do want to call in.
I would like to say, Ms. Cassidy, I don't mean to interrupt. You brought the Vatican.
No problem.
Yeah, I would like to address the Vatican. And
please
its
go right
connection
ahead
to the United States military. What many people don't understand, to put this into perspective for you, my father was a good Catholic. He was basically a practicing Catholic. Later on in his life, a lapsed Catholic, but he was able to give confessions before his death. And so he died at least loosely within the Catholic matrix. And I do want to emphasize that the Church has been an integral part of European history and identity. There is no doubt it has suffered an enormous amount of corruption. And to put that into perspective, just like any police, our security agency, our intelligence agency that is working with, say, for instance, international crime or corruption, it is going to become, of just sheer exposure to everything it's dealing with, infested with corrupt cops and corrupt administrators. And in the end, certain police forces, if you don't deconstruct them completely, you need to scour them completely. The Catholic Church is going through that. The Catholic Church may not survive this in the form that we know it today, but the Catholic Church needs to be recognized as one of those pillars of European identity. That being said, during the Second World War, based on their enormous amount of power from history, they
get sheer exposure to everything it's dealing with.
I'm getting the feedback here. Do you hear that?
Please turn off your radio, 760.
Yeah.
Okay, it sounds like we've got a caller on the line. Okay,
sure.
I'm sorry, Douglas, that you were interrupted there, but I think that your point was made. Did you want to finish your sentence?
Yes, during the Second World War, the Vatican reestablished an actual military empire in the form of Croatia. and in Croatia, which I got to be painfully familiar with through my mercenary service in the Balkans, the Vatican organized Europe's first concentration camps, the only concentration camps ever exclusively run for children, because their policy was exterminate half, one-third of the population, convert one-third of the population, and expel one-third of the population. Towards this end, Catholic nuns ran extermination camps for children in Dubno and Lovnitz. And at the point during World War II, at the height of the conflict, the Vatican paid the United States Army never to bomb Croatia. And rather than bomb Croatia, the Americans wound up bombing their only ally in World War II, the Serbs. So people are familiar with hundreds of thousands of Germans dying, as well as 900,000 Japanese, 62,000 Italians due to American bombing campaigns. Most people don't know 24,000 Serbs died. Basically, after the Serbs had rescued over 600 Allied airmen, 521 of which were U.S. citizens, delivered them to a pickup point in Operation Halyard. This was the largest single recovery of American military personnel in modern recorded warfare. The Americans responded when they got gold from the Vatican by bombing Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, at high noon on Serb Orthodox Easter in 1944, right after church feast, so they could kill more people than ever would be concentrated otherwise. 10,000 civilian Serbs in Belgrade alone on April 27th of 1944. That's what your American Army Air Corps is like. They will take protection money not to bomb. They will take money in order to bomb their own allies. So please keep that in mind when you hear these men talking to you about all their honor and all their service and what they do. I'll tell you, I personally knew Mr. Richard Feldman. He was an American airman of Jewish descent, and if the Germans had caught him, he would have gone straight to a concentration camp. He lived in Phoenix, Arizona, till the day he died. He dedicated his life to finding out what happened behind the American bombing campaign against the Serbs. He himself had watched with binoculars when the Serbs hit him, and the Germans executed every villager because they refused to give his hiding place away. And he literally saw about 221 Serbs sacrifice their lives for him. And then as soon as he got back to base, they told him to go and bomb the Serbs. He refused to do so. He was put in jail for a while. Then all the Americans went and bombed all the men who just rescued them. This is the kind of corruption that we're talking about in terms of Vatican military politics. So
okay.
I did want to get that out there.
Thank you for that. You know, your grasp of the facts and figures and the exposure to the historical sort of, I guess, documentation, and also your personal experience is quite a sort of package to take on board. And it's great to hear you talk about all these various incidents. Now we do have a caller holding on the line, don't we? Caller, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Cool. Hey, my name's Amanda and I'm calling from Baltimore, and I just want to say, Carrie, I love your shows and your blog.
Thank you.
And thanks for doing what you do. And Doug, I'm interested in any experiences you might have had with remote viewing.
Oh, thank you for asking. I mean, I can certainly go into what little I know. Basically, remember that remote viewing was more of a CIA type of program as opposed to what the Army was dealing with. What the Army was dealing with was more of a sorcery as opposed to remote viewing. But basically, what I can tell you is pretty much no different from what other remote viewers can tell you. Basically, there were a lot of government field manuals in remote viewing that I was able to look at. I never bothered taking any of them home. There are some certain celebrities who did wind up with a few of these government field manuals, and they wound up selling them and making a career out of it. But in my case, it was mostly dealing with sorcery. Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino was always pointing out how cost-effective that sorcery could be, as opposed to amassing armies. So that was a big part of his selling point to the U.S. military, and probably one of the major factors of what Ms. Cassidy brought up concerning the lawsuit by other Christian chaplaincies in the Army against him.
Well, that was one of the things I was wondering about. Like, you know, you had such great access to a lot of, like, that stuff. Was there any type of written document that you felt needed to be publicized and made known to the public?
I'm trying to make them publicized today through what I'm doing, and what I do is I try to point people out to where they can find information on this. Mostly when I talk about the impact of sorcery on the military, I bring up certain weapon systems that the sorcery is very integrated with. One of them would be HARP, but that would take an entirely different discussion. That would take us about an hour to cover that with any justice. But
Well, I'm sorry we didn't actually go there. I would like to, you know, to have broached that subject with you, and perhaps we can have you back to do just that. Caller, I'm going to have to let you go because I want to allow other people to ask some questions as well. But thank you very much for your call and your good questions.
Thank you, Amanda.
All right. Okay.
Thank you. So do we have another caller on the line, or shall I go to my I have a chat room here that where they're also asking questions.
You do have 734 on the line.
All right. Go right ahead. 734. If you are on the line with us. Go right ahead.
Hi. This is another caller from the chat room. I had a question about the connection of any of this sorcery to the Nazi occult network that migrated into the U.S. military and government from Project Paperclip and other similar programs after the war. Was there any connection that you know of to Nazi occultists?
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes and no. Basically, what Americans see with Project Paperclip, that was mostly a scientific and technical exchange program with the Third Reich's government in exile. So Project Paperclip allowed a lot of observers, and that's what they considered themselves to be. They considered themselves to be observers for the Third Reich in exile. They did not consider themselves to be prisoners or in any way, shape, or form working under duress. They were observers. It was the same way with any Nazi occultists. Keep in mind that Nazis get along with Satanists not at all. Nazism, particularly through the SS, also Schutzstaffel under Heinrich Himmler, was a Gnostic paganism. And what Heinrich Himmler in particular was attempting to do through the genocide of the Konzertflogen and ultimately the Totenflogen, the death camps, was to sacrifice enough people to use that energy to rip a hole in the fabric of the space-time continuum and bring back the elder gods of the Norsk, of Woden, of Thor, of Freya, of these various pagan deities that they would walk the earth once more. Totally different from the satanic agenda of the United States. And Nazis no more get along with Satanists than they would with communists. And so the Nazis despised the American Satanists, and the Satanists returned that loathing in full measure. As a matter of fact, many people confuse Colonel Michael Aquino when he went to Germany and he held a ritual within Wevelsburg Castle, formerly Heinrich Himmler's castle of the Black Order of the SS. People thought that he was doing something that was affiliated with Nazism. Nothing could be further from the truth. The man was under NATO orders to conduct a suppression ritual to keep the elder gods from breaking through into the space-time continuum and keep them out of our reality for at least another few decades. And in this sense, he was making his satanic divinities that he worshipped and that the United States military hierarchy worshipped much stronger. That all had to do, ultimately, in connection, as unbelievable as this is, with projects such as HARP and other occult technology projects. And
I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure that that's completely correct. Now, there may be, you're talking about maybe the purest roots of what you call paganism and Nazism versus Satanism. But my understanding is that there are, at some point, there was a sort of emergence of the two, because my understanding is that the Bushes and that group are Satanists, and they're also Nazis.
Yes, this is similar to the Nazi-Communist kind of cooperation that happened during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, in which there are agreements not to invade each other's territories or to interfere with each other's spheres of influence. And as a result, you get certain kinds of ideological developments, such as the army of General Vlasov, which was National Bolshevik, which is an ideology where they are Soviet, but not Stalinist. In other words, they believed that the Bolshevik Revolution was just and that the proletarian had to be brought into power to deal away with a corrupt tsardom. But at the same time, they were not Stalinist because he turned it into a personality cult. It's a very specific kind of ideological subdivision.
Yes, that's what the Bush dynasty. I'm not sure the analogy holds because of what you're talking about, paganism and Satanism versus Nazism. My understanding, well, is if you go into the background of Nazism, you actually end up with Satanists.
No, that definitely is not the case. That was the case in the Bush dynasty, where you had people who were Satanists, but then they were picking up a veneer of National Socialist connections. That was basically that what they were cultivating more than anything else was, for lack of a better word, business connections in the business of occult trading for reliquary, what they would call various relics that they needed for their own occult rituals. So
okay.
In that sense, there was kind of an ideological exchange program, but that, like,
well,
Boyd
let me
Wright,
ask you this. I mean, because, you know, because let's get down to the nitty gritty here. The army is under the wing of certainly Bush and that group, and the army is also under, you know, has this satanic chaplain, right?
Yes.
So in a sense, they're both running the place, you know, from maybe different angles or whatever. And maybe if you become a purist in this regard, then maybe you do split hairs in that to some degree. But and I understand how, I mean, I would be curious, does Michael Aquino consider himself a Nazi?
No, that was something that was very misinterpreted by the public media, and something which he did nothing to discourage, because the man is responsible for generating himself as a bodyguard of lies. The man was responsible for PSYOPs. The man was, it was one of his responsibilities to mislead the American public. So in that sense, he didn't care that the American public misinterpreted him in that direction. To specify, there were Nazi Satanists in the American vein, such as Boyd Rice. His name is spelled just like the food, and people can look him up. He was a celebrity in his day. That was a neo-Nazi in the United States who was heavily involved with Satanism. He was girlfriends with Zena for a while, at least, Anton Zandor LaVey's daughter. So he was very involved with the satanic crowd. Okay, this is totally different from the government of the Third Reich. This is purely an American phenomenon. And
okay, if many people would say that what we have in America right now is actually the Fourth Reich. And
I understand
fact,
that a lot of people say that.
Book.
That's like a public kind of impression, and it's very difficult to deal with this. But I'm going to have to do my best to try and educate the public so that they're not misled. The problem
okay, well,
that they,
you know, we've only got four minutes left, and I, you know, this is an interesting discussion, and I'm happy to have it with you in
because,
more depth.
Yeah, just to clarify, because this has to be said, it's like talking economics. People keep using the term fascist. They use the term fascist either in terms of America's new economics, or they use it in terms of Islamism. They say Islamicism is Islamofascism. It's a totally ridiculous term, because fascism is a modern industrial ideology as opposed to Islamicism, which is pre-industrial and medievalist. And
right.
The economics of fascism are totally different from communism or capitalism. So this is what it's similar to, just to bring it home to people. This is why I argue so much with these economists who misuse that term. I have progressive liberals who are essentially communists calling everybody who's a conservative a fascist. I have a bunch of conservative right-wing reactionaries on the other side who are calling everybody who's liberal progressive as basically a crypto-fascist. So they're both calling each other fascist.
Okay, well, what I want to ask you, though, in regard to the super soldiers, do you feel that there is a strong satanic element to the sort of mind control that went on with super soldiers?
Indisputably, yes.
Okay, and I wish we had two more hours to discuss that, but we don't. So I'm very sorry. We just don't have any more time. According to my information here, I've got less than 3 minutes. Again, they're saying I can go over if I like. If they're allowing me to go over, if there's a way that you could cover that, you know, that sort of topic of how Satanism branches into or has some kind of involvement in the development of super soldiers and or, you know, super victims, as you call them.
Yes. Basically, that comes from a sacrifice of the soul on a personal level that Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino and the affiliates that he served as satanic chaplain to were trying to develop. And in this sense, they were trying to take an integrated soul and fracture it into smaller and smaller fragments that it would be easily manipulable and consumed, ultimately become not only theirs, but the possession of the entities which they served. And in terms of that process, many people were taken out of orphanages or from families, basically adopted, so to speak, into state programs. And these state programs would begin to fracture these young people's personalities into multiple personas. And persona stems from the Greek word for mask. And the personas would be basically, they would start them, for instance, by bringing them to animal shelters, having them adopt several puppies and kittens, raise them until they bonded with these animals, and then were given orders to murder them. They would have the children themselves murder the animals that they had bonded with, puppies and kittens. This would be the primal trauma that would fracture their personalities into a denial. And then they would graduate them up onto the level of human beings in that regard. Most of them would become bond kill agents. See, this isn't like when I use this term super soldier program, it's really a misnomer, and I detest it and really do not like that term. Unfortunately, it's stuck. And the reality is we're not talking about something as popularized through this series of films, the Universal Soldier Program with Jean-Claude Van Damme, where you've got big strapping individuals putting on Kevlar and marching into the field. Nothing at all like that. You basically have frail young ladies and boys who are taken and abused to the point where they become fragmented personalities who Satanism comes involved with the ritual aspects of their dedication of their souls to darker energies. And this is where the child daycare center scandal was so inextricably involved. And always important to remember, there is no legal evidence that will convict Colonel Aquino, at least not in this stage of history that I know of. And believe me, I'm far more familiar with the case than most. But what happened is I can guarantee you an enormous amount of people were involved with that scandal. My high school teacher, Gary Willard Hambright, was an ordained Southern Baptist minister without a pulpit, it must be emphasized, who was homeless. He lived in a church in San Francisco, but he taught at the San Francisco Unified School District. Now, as I said, he was federally indicted for assaulting any number of children. Well, these children weren't just coming down with AIDS. And I'm sure that many of them that were infected with AIDS, which numbered to 500,000, sourced from this man's abuses over half a decade. But the problem was that they were also coming down with SIF. They were coming down with HEP. They were coming down with chlamydia. They were coming down with every sexually transmitted disease you can imagine. Now, not even a scumbag like Gary Hambright could be harboring all of those STDs and remain ambulatory, let alone sexually active. So the point is, many people were involved in those abuses. The children, remember, would often claim to be taken from one tunnel to from one building to another through the enormous tunnel system that existed beneath the Presidio. Now, the Presidio was 1,500 acres, and the oldest building in San Francisco is the Presidio's Officers Club, which was right across the street from where I was incinerating documents in the library. And that was built in 1776. So we've got buildings on the Presidio that were as old as any building or most buildings on the Maritime Republics of the 13 original colonies of the United States. And in terms, it was organized by the conquistadors. They enslaved the Ohlone tribe, which they forced to dig massive tunnels to mine for gold. The Americans expanded those tunnels and reinforced them when they used it as a coastal artillery garrison. Then they would lead line and use for Nike Zeus missile systems to take out incoming ballistic missiles if there were any attack on the Western Defense Command Center and the 6th Army headquarters of the United States. And yes. So those tunnel systems were expanded, and they still exist. I burned all the maps. I was given orders during that child daycare scandal.
You're kidding.
No, I was given orders by my operations manager during the child daycare center scandal and its ongoing implications and repercussions towards the high command to take those maps and incinerate them. As far as I understand, there are no extant maps of the miles of tunnel systems beneath 1,500 acres of the Presidio military base. Now, of course, it's national parkland, which the national parkland has abused by renting out to private ownerships. George Lewis, Lucas, but I'm sorry.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, but let me ask you, doing the job you did and you come across documents that you must have said to yourself, this is worth saving from time to time, you didn't feel the desire to make a copy or, you know, and keep your own stash?
of course, that's how I got away with some things like the Roswell fragments. There's only so much I could get away with. Taking copious notes is one thing. In terms of stealing or photocopying even, very difficult. As corrupt, as incompetent, as stupid and lazy as my superiors were, one of the things that they had a maniacal, pathological routinization of was checking the amount of toner in the photocopy machine. They would check it as soon as they got
really?
To work. They would check it when they left the work just to make sure nothing was ever photocopied. One of the ways that I got away with things, like taking notes and tracing documents, I traced blueprints, things that seemed important to me, and I would get the use basically materials that belonged to private corporations like RAND / MIT think tanks that were contracted to the Department of Defense because no one was monitoring their assets or their private supplies. So I could get away with that. But the government documents, much harder to steal, and I could have spent the rest of my life in jail, which I was risking anyway by taking much of what I did. Photographs were almost impossible. It was lucky that I got out with some of them. And when it came to stuff like these maps, he stood over my shoulder while I incinerated them. He stood over my shoulder and made sure I wasn't writing anything down or doing any copying when I incinerated them. So I hope that puts that into perspective, because the high command wanted these things destroyed to totally destroy any evidence of those tunnel systems.
Okay. Now, in terms of your relationship with Michael Aquino, because, you know, these things don't happen very accidentally. And I don't know, it sounds like you did study remote viewing. I don't know whether you've ever had yourself regressed or anything else. But it seems to me that it could not have been accidental that you ended up to work with this man on some level. Sounds like on a fairly regular basis. Have you ever examined that?
Well, it's something that I examine to an extent, but in terms of being assigned his liaison, it was just part of that general situation of let Douglas Dietrich do it. It was pretty much along the lines of nobody was doing anything in the facility, and the end result was I was the only person there coming from a Confucianist background. Having been born in Taiwan, I had a Confucianist work ethic, which was the closest thing in the postmodern world to a Puritan work ethic that the Americans used to have when they originally colonized the United States. So since I was the only person who was working, it was just really that and that alone, which led to a liaison status with Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino. It was just basically let Douglas do it. Also, Michael Aquino looks like a chubby Dracula, and he looks like the uncle from the Addams Family, and Douglas looks like Eddie Munster or Herman Munster from the Munsters, and, you know, and put them together, and everybody can have a good laugh. Everybody thought that I was his illegitimate son. So aside from, you know, the yucks they were getting out of it and the fact that
Well, what do you mean? I'm sorry. It's sort of a throwaway comment, and I don't mean to psychoanalyze you here on the air. But you know, coming from Project Camelot, as you can appreciate, and you may not be, again, familiar with our videos, our interviews, et cetera. But, I do a lot of in-depth interviewing, and there are no coincidences in this world as far as I'm concerned. And so if you're saying, you're saying that people think you look alike, you look like his son? Or
yeah,
was
it was
that
a comment.
Joke?
It was a comment that was made quite a few times whenever I was escorting him on his various responsibilities. One of the reasons why I was exposed to so much information from him was there were two factors. Well, one of them was it was inescapable. First off, I took his calls. So as a result, he had to basically, as the person who was controlling his correspondence to an extent, at least acting as a kind of mobile receptionist. And in those days, we didn't have cell phones. It was a totally different world. A lot of younger people don't appreciate that or understand the nuances of that. Because of that, as his kind of mobile secretary, during several of the activities he was involved with, I got to know a lot of the length, the breadth, the depth of his operations in a way that was inescapable. He couldn't avoid that. So I had to know what was going on with what he was involved with, at least to that extent. There are things he was involved with that were out of sight, meaning off the site, the Presidio military base, such as what happened to him in Virginia, where there was an enormous investigation concerning the cult, the satanic cult of officers that he led in Virginia that I got very little information on. There was some involvement with the West Point, where I heard a lot about the satanic scandals at West Point and what was going on with the children of child abuse over there. But at that point, I had no control over getting better access to that. That I learned more of through the repercussions of what had occurred as opposed to it happening right there on site, the Presidio military base. So that's what I speak mostly to. But in terms of, yes, while we're going around the base, there was always these impressions. A lot of people didn't know that he was half Italian, half German, because the guy wore full-face pancake makeup on duty while he was in full uniform. He had the widow's peak, the clipped eyebrows. He was basically going to work in a costume and was able to get away with it because of the constitutional right to freedom of religion. And he said that was his religious expression. So he looked like something out of a horror film. And because of my own looks, people would make the joke that I looked like his illegitimate son. So it was just a running joke. But okay, in terms of, not to dismiss what you're saying in terms of, say, seriousness, to give a serious aspect to it, he considered me as very much a potential candidate for the conversion.
Just because of my, I have studied the occult and I have studied various aspects of this, and there's, you know, there are definitely overtones here going on, not only on that level, but, you know, you must have been a young man at that point, right?
That is quite so. As a matter of fact, I started working as a librarian's aide when I was 16 years old, and it does, due to certain things that happened, I became more and more of a potential candidate as far as he was concerned. So he did much to try and recruit me. He took me to the Satanic Monastery of the 1st Earth Battalion underneath Lieutenant Colonel James Channon at the time. I believe he probably retired a full colonel. And James Channon, organizing the 1st Earth Battalion, they actually established a Satanic Monastery in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I was taken to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we were touring these various sites because he was attempting to convert me. And, of course, I was on duty. I was assigned his liaison. So when I took these longer jaunts of trips with him, it was on an official and recognized status. It wasn't like he and I were chumming and taking a car ride down casually.
But I mean, in that role, you end up becoming a sort of a confidant and a friend.
Very much so, in a
loose sense of that word, right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. Yes, very much so. And he ultimately hoped that I would convert. He had respect for me, and I have respect for him. He is a man to be respected and feared in terms of his dedication to his cause being so complete. And
how did you resist being recruited?
Well, there were a number of things that occurred that were certainly – I bring up one of these in the DVD, and people can see my discussion of this in some interviews that have been on other networks. But in terms of certain experiences that I've had while rituals were being conducted, there are rituals that go awry, and there are rituals where everything goes wrong that can possibly go wrong. And certainly after having experienced the collateral damage of one of those occult meltdowns, I can certainly tell you that I knew that I would never become involved with the spirituality that he was advocating and evoking. He maintains every confidence that when he dies, he will go to hell and he will sit by his master's side.
Right.
And I, of course, knowing by some of the entities that he was dealing with, as he knew, was that there are things from which hell itself recoils. What many people don't understand is that what we refer to as daemons, or demonic entities, are in a certain kind of sense cosmic mosquitoes. They feed off of human sufferings and failings and foibles. And they are the higher end of the food chain in lower dimensions. However, they are utterly dependent, as any parasite is, on the host. They need humanity as much as humanity feeds them. However, there are entities that have no need for humanity at all, and even demons themselves fail and fear in such presences.
So it sounds to me, though, as though you got quite a spiritual, for lack of a better title, or term, education.
Yes.
Being in these roles that you, because you were, you have been, if you don't mind my saying so, in some very dark places.
Yes. As to give you an example, when I had to provide care provision for my parents in their terminal decade, I had to perforce attain a medical education the wrong way. I wound up attending almost a decade of medical journalism courses at UCSF, where my surgery had been performed in order to better advocate for my parents during their terminal decade. And in that sense, I also had to make up for every mistake the doctors made in the United States medical industrial complex. Misdiagnosis, misprescription or misadministration of prescription meds, malpractices led to more and more things that destroyed my parents' life and quality of life that I had to constantly back up and get education for to compensate for. In that sense, I also got a theological education the wrong way. I learned very much about the darkness of the universe around us, and it is important to remember that the overwhelming physical majority of our universe is comprised of dark matter. Everything that you know and love, everyone you know and love, everything that makes life wonderful is a candle flame flickering in that immense darkness. And it is always easier to work with the darkness than it is with the light. It's simply so much more available. And as an end result,
I appreciate that has been your perspective, and it's quite a fascinating sort of revelatory, you know, place to be in where you've come from. I'm not going to attempt to disagree with you there, but I have to say that it's, you know, your phrasing is quite fascinating. You understand, coming from where you come from, I'm sure it makes perfect logical sense. Having dealt with the kind of world that you were dealing with, I mean, in a sense, it actually sounds in a sort of way, you know, I come from Northern California. I'm very familiar with the vibration of the Presidio. The Presidio in San Francisco is an extremely dark place. Yeah. And so I have to say, if you worked in the Presidio, even if you didn't have the exposure that you had with all these other various things, including being close to Michael Aquino, you would have experienced just a tremendous amount of darkness. And that clearly was something you set yourself up for in this life. And now you're going about being, in a sense, a whistleblower for that. And I really do appreciate that. And I want to thank you very much for the courage that it takes for a person to do what you're doing.
I appreciate that. And people have asked about that, if I don't feel a personal danger from Colonel Michael Aquino. Well, as I've explained in some of my interviews and on the DVD, Satan's Crusaders itself, due to a possession that I experienced as a result of one of the occult rituals gone awry, conducted just incompetently by his followers when he was not present, that has left me harboring something that he desires. I have my own collateral against his invasions, psychic, occult, or otherwise. So it is something that hopefully people will pursue on their own and be able to come to their own conclusions. But it was certainly a point of discussion amongst the fathers of the Byzantine Orthodox Church when I was converted to Christianity, as to whether my soul was eternally damned as a result of that possession, or whether I was redeeming myself by what I was doing in terms of the security work as approved by the Byzantine Orthodox Catholic Church of the Serbian state. So it's an interesting theological discussion.
Yeah, it is. Well, let me ask you just point blank, though, just because you brought it up. In light of that, and assuming that, you know, that you got clear or sort of mastered that possession, and that it hasn't, you know, returned, it's not returning, in other words, you know, it's not recurring. And you can address that or not. It's up to you, because I don't mean to get too personal here. But at the same time, with that in mind, this is where we circle back to the so-called super soldiers or super victims, or actually, you know, some would say just victims of MKUltra in the loosest sense, where Satanism crosses into that. Are you there?
No, absolutely. And we've explained the connection with the Satanism and the super soldiers. And
at a certain point, so what this does, though, is see, this is your direct experience with this, right?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact.
And so you would know also if you've had any experience with super soldiers or been studying them, their own experience. In other words, there's a form of possession that is also part of being a super soldier, right?
That is correct. There is an element of having a demonic entity enter their physical vessel at a certain point in conditioning, at least for some that are chosen. And that essentially haunts them throughout their lives, and it is something that they would have to contend with, because obviously formal churches, established churches that have been around for hundreds if not thousands of years, such as the Byzantine Orthodox or the Catholic Church, would insist that personal exorcism doesn't work. Basically, the argument is just as a man can defend himself or defend his family, when it comes to the security of a town or a village, then at that point you need a sheriff. And then at some point, when it comes to the larger and larger aggregates of humanity, you need larger and larger aggregates of security. So too, on a spiritual sense, there are entities which thrive off the despolation of the soul itself, as opposed to social corruptions or vices. And that's where the church enters. And the church stance is that personal exorcisms, such as performed by many revivalist Christians or evangelical Christians in the United States, they look on those as non-functional or dysfunctional anymore. It would be the equivalent of a vigilante as opposed to an enforcement official trying to fight crime. So
there's also, they have a vested interest in keeping that perception of the church, though, as an organization. They want to feel that they, you know, in other words, that gives them a jurisdiction,
yes,
in a sense.
There is certainly that. And but in terms of the question being, can these super soldiers overcome what essentially they may have become demonically infested with?
Right.
That is a question.
Okay, and what is your answer to that? I mean, you must have had enough experience to have a point of view on that.
Well, I think that my conclusion is that there is a need for standardized churches that are recognized as establishments, which is probably different from a conclusion most Americans would draw. It rankles with them because most Americans have come to the United States to escape the restrictions imposed by certain religious forms of civilization that have developed in the world around us. But I feel that as we are entering a new dark age, it's going to be very similar to the last dark age. And in the last dark age, past being prelude, there was no such thing as politics. A man's religion was his politics. And as a result of that, my perspective is that we're going to see less and less of an establishment of nations, more and more of a territorial integration of churches. There was no such thing as Europe in the last dark age. The closest concept that we had was Christendom. I see a return to that state of mind, that frame of paradigm. And as a result, I have a respect for churches as establishments. And perhaps that was what led to my formal conversion officially to Byzantine Orthodoxy, because of a hope for ultimately an establishment-oriented monitoring on my spiritual condition.
Okay, and how do you feel? I mean, do you feel that did you have an exorcism performed on you? Do you feel that's how you got sort of through this, or what transpired, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, what transpired on the night that I was transitionally possessed due to that that occult ritual gone awry? Do we have time enough where I can go into that, or do you just want me to talk about what we did to kind of get rid of, to pull through that situation? It was basically, as ad hoc, as jury rigged as one can imagine in terms of expelling that particular entity that we were contending with. And, the end result is, it's like my exposure to cyclosari nerve gas. I will never get over the repercussions of that. It's simply physically impossible. On the level of the cyclosari nerve gas, it is spiritually impossible on the level of that transitional possession. A part of me will always be missing. Something disappeared that day that I will never regain. And something was certainly left. And as for my contending with that, I contend with it in the same sense that I deal with the effects of the cyclosarine nerve gas. Basically, to give you an example of this, the cyclosarine gas was used against the people in the Tokyo subway train system by Yomo Shinrikyo when they skulked underneath Asahara Shoko, basically tried to use those nerve agents to kill thousands and potentially hundreds of thousands of people throughout Tokyo during the height of its rush hour, in which many, many thousands of people use that subway system. You have 30 million people in Tokyo. So he was trying to kill many, many people. Many people who became afflicted with that gas, it degenerates the mind. And at later points in life, they were famous for conducting crimes unheard of in Japan. Schoolyard massacres with machine guns through drive-bys as their brains degenerated under the effects of cyclosarine nerve gas. The end result was it destroys the neurological system in such a way that the brain begins to function in increasingly violent patterns. And my way of contending with the amount of cyclosarine nerve gas that I was afflicted with is to constantly keep my mind occupied, constantly keep in communications with not just other people, but the world in general. In that way, I can certainly monitor my own behavior and make certain that my mind continues to function as opposed to neurologically degenerate despite the effect that it's had in debilitating my body. And in terms of myself spiritually, it's the same kind of technique that I use. Basically, okay. Make certain that I interact enough with the public around me so that I maintain myself suppressed in that regard. And in both cases, so far, it seems to have worked admirably. I at least perform a public service in making the public aware of these forces, and both social and extra-dimensional or spiritual, depending on how one interprets it, as well as historical. So that keeps my intellect and my spirit from degenerating into what else could otherwise happen.
Well, I thank you, and thank you for that. I understand that these may not be simple questions, and you're answering them very, very honestly and quite a bit of astuteness, and I believe that you also thought about these things quite a bit. Kudos to you for that. There are people that would perhaps like to go into that more. I am not sure how much longer we should go on this, and it is up to you to some degree. What they've done at the radio show here is normally my show would have ended, almost a half hour ago. And they do something else after that half hour. So we've been on the air for about 2.5 hours, and I don't want to, tax you too much. But it's up to you. What would you think at this point? Would you like to come back at another time and we could go into some more of these various aspects that we haven't been able to touch on, like the HARP situation, et cetera, et cetera? Or what is your thought?
Oh, I could discuss such things now. I'm not antithetical to that. It depends on how you feel. If you're willing to go for at least another half hour, I'd be willing to go for it, and we could touch on the HARP situation as well as we are able.
Okay, that would be fine. I think that what this does, just so you understand maybe a little bit of where I'm going with it, is that we obviously are in a spiritual war on planet Earth. And these kinds of battles that are being fought, a lot of them are certainly not being put in the news, needless to say, but there are also a lot of people that are sort of out there and very vulnerable to things of this sort, but they don't know anything about it. So they don't even know how to fight something like that because they don't even realize when they're being sort of invaded, so to speak. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I agree.
And so just let me finish one more sentence, definitely want to hear your reaction. And so what happens when you have a super soldier and you break them down to altars, et cetera, what you can also do, it depends what you want to classify them as. I would have said what Satanists do, but also, you would say what, the different disciplines do is at that point, they also can create a portal in a person. Such as there are openings through which these demonic entities then come. And the openings, once they're created, it's very hard for a person to close them down. Now, I don't think anything is out of our control, okay, as humans. I actually think very highly of this entity we call human. So I actually believe we can change our DNA, and I believe there's evidence to this. And I believe we can also heal ourselves in countless ways that we don't even realize at this time, that we've been dumbed down to such an extent that we don't realize our true powers. But be that as it may, under your circumstances, you've had exposure directly to some of these things. And not only that, but you're now talking about super soldiers or, you know, victims of MKUltra who also have dealt with this and had to deal with this, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But keep in mind, what I've done is the same thing that I do with a lot of other subjects. When it comes to the super soldiers, one of the reasons that I'm delivering the open presentation is to provide people a narrative, a context in which to hear the super soldiers' experiences, because the greatest problem that many people face and the challenge that most people have had is that they do not have a narrative in which to contextualize their experiences, and therefore their experiences can break them as individuals. A good example would be in a video that I put up on my Facebook wall, which is easily accessible through my website at douglasdietrich.com. Just go to the big blue button that says Facebook and just scroll down. It'll be well worth it to find the video, The Dark Side of Yaldora. And Dark Side of Yaldora talks about one Gulf War veteran's experience with a U.S. Army Ranger unit that had a satanic chaplain. Now, they never bring that up. They never say, oh, this man was a satanic chaplain, but I recognized immediately the rituals he was performing that this U.S. Army Ranger photographed and was trying to bring up before an American war crimes tribunal, because everywhere they were going, it wasn't just like one incident where everyone went nuts and suddenly performed a massacre. This was repeatedly. They were killing civilians, all male, and they were smashing their heads open either with a bullet to the brain casing unit or with their gun butts and removing the brains and holding them aloft in a sacrament. That I recognized instantly as a satanic sacrament and a satanic chaplaincy at work. Now, this ranger had no idea of what he was witnessing. He wound up psychologically breaking down completely, and after an enormous series of abuses and tortures was sent back to the United States, where he ultimately died after killing a few people. And the end result was he had no narrative or context into which to place what was happening. You mentioned before super soldiers being selected. I mean, certainly I explained how I grew up utilizing the Letterman Army Medical Center due to the health problems
Absolutely.
I was faced with. And there were several times that once I was in there with bleeding duodenal ulcers at the age of 16, where I was there for quite some time because of the enormous amount of blood transfusions that had to be conducted. And there was a woman who was in the Letterman Army Medical Center whose head was shaven, and she came in to talk to me every once in a while because she was like a permanent patient. And her head was literally wired. She had a circuit that was in her skull. It was the damnedest thing. And as at 16 years of age, I had no appreciation for that that I did later on as an adult. Now, certainly, because of the diagnosis I received, growing up in the Tenderloin, being exposed to so many of the horrors that I was exposed to, the kind of violence I was exposed to. I mean, to give you an example, we had audio cassettes in those days, and the audio cassette recorder of my neighborhood, I would turn on an audio cassette to record something from the television. We didn't have VCRs in those days. That's how long ago it was. And that audio cassette, when replayed, it was nothing but screams, gunfire, crashing windows, alarms and sirens. That's all you heard. That was what I was hearing 24 hours a day, and it was so much in the back of my mind, I didn't realize that that's all that would ever come out on
Wow.
an open audio cassette picking up ambient noise. So when I was taken at a very young age to the Letterman Army Medical Center, they told my father, by that time, that was the first time they had developed the diagnosis of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, had just been developed. Until that time, after the Vietnam War, it was shortly after the Vietnam War, we're talking about the very early 1980s, Vietnam War ended 1973 to 1975. They were still using terms like battle fatigue, shell shock, you know, combat exhaustion. Finally, they developed this PTSD. I was one of the first people in the United States diagnosed with PTSD at the age of 15 when they brought me in there, because
yeah.
there were military doctors. It was a U.S. Army hospital, and they gave me a military diagnosis. They tell my dad, your son has PTSD. He's post-traumatic stress disorder. So with that ongoing and the kind of things I was exposed to at Letterman, where so many experiments were being conducted, who is to say that I hadn't been selected by Aquino long before I was chosen or assigned his liaison status?
Sure. Absolutely. So, well, I mean, it's great that you entertain that possibility, and everyone listening to this is certainly, connecting these dots. There are things that have gone on in your life that don't seem, in other words, the possibility for them to be a coincidence. I don't know. I'm not a mathematician, but I just think the odds would be astronomical.
I understand what you're saying. I seem to have had quite the penchant for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. all too many times and all too many places. But the end result
is... Well, certainly being sort of groomed for something and on the light or the dark. And it's quite possible that this is your soul trajectory, that you're set up these certain challenges for yourself in order to accomplish certain things. And, this is what goes on. What I want to do at this point is take sort of a jog. And I'm not going to keep you for that much longer, but I would like to just graze upon the HARP situation.
Yes.
If you can talk about why it is you're wrapping a HARP into sort of this satanic scenario, it would be fascinating.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate very much your bringing that up. And believe it or not, it goes back to World War II, and I'm going to cover this as briefly as possible. In my DVD, Satan's Crusaders, available through the website, DouglasDietrich.com, I explain the occult rituals performed by the Japanese during the kamikaze effort of the war. And the entire idea was the sacrifice of the warrior to prove themselves worthy as a people for bringing forth the ancient gods of Japan, the kami, the spirits of Japan, to thwart the United States in its invasions, attempts at Japan.
So a blood sacrifice.
Yes, it was a blood sacrifice of the self. And everybody who tells you, oh, this was some last act of desperation on the part of certain elements of the military, is basically lying both to you and possibly to themselves. Because the reality was everyone knew about it. My mother was born in Tokyo. She was part of the Japanese Empire. She served as an interpreter. Everyone in Japan knew about and supported the kamikaze effort. It was a spiritual mobilization of mass sacrifice on the part of the warriors to bring forth the effects of the kami. And it worked. And I go into that in the DVD.
Well,
the Americans
let me
were
just
inspired.
Say that, well, yeah. I just have to stop you there because the Islamic militant who also sacrifices himself is doing the same thing. That's also an occult ritual.
It is, but on a personal level. The Japanese were doing this on a mass level.
No, I think, I believe this is a cultural, it is a cultural phenomena. But be that as it may, okay, go right ahead as far as the rest of this.
Yes, some other time we can go into the cultural differences between Islamic and Japanese mysticism. But in terms of the Americans, they were faced not only with that, but they were faced with the jet stream, which the Japanese knew about because their emperor was a marine biologist and had worked for years with the Kuroshio, the Japanese current, which is the maritime equivalent of the jet stream. And the jet stream is a river of air coincident with that, which crosses 6,000 miles of ocean, and it only goes in one direction, towards the United States, away from Japan. And this swift-flowing river of air, the Americans knew absolutely nothing about until they started trying to bomb the Japanese. Then they're facing at 20,000 feet, winds that reach a speed of 30 to 60 miles an hour or even faster. And at 25,000 feet, the 60-mile-per-hour air current was such that all of the bombers in the United States were forced to hit the ground, so to speak, expose themselves to Japanese anti-aircraft fire. And as a result, they had thousands, literally thousands of bombardiers who wound up parachuting over Japan and, of course, dying as a result. And the end result was the Americans were confronted with the reality of that and conceptualized the jet stream. They said, we've lost 5,000 downed bombardiers over Japan because of the jet stream, and there was only 80 survivors, less than that, who were lucky enough to get caught by the police or the military in Japan and used for interrogation purposes. Otherwise, the Japanese population understandably tore them apart limb from limb. So the Americans said, let's work on an electromagnetic generation system that can reverse the jet stream, come a resumption of conflict with the Empire of Japan. That was the genesis point for Project HARP. It became occulted or involved with occult aspects under the Aquino influence on the military. Now, HARP actually is H, A cubed, R squared, P squared, and it stands for High Frequency Activated Auroral Atmospheric Resonance Research Projection Program. And this enormous array in Kokona, Alaska, basically is stationed there because that dominates the North Pacific. That was why, during World War II, the Battle of Midway took place, which the Japanese won. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. They lost four carriers, and they got what they wanted. And in terms of the loss ratios and everything else, the Americans turned it into an American Trafalgar. Well, the Americans failed. The Japanese succeeded in what they intended because Midway was a distraction from the invasion of Alaska. The Japanese held Alaska throughout the rest of the war. Of all of the war effort into the Pacific, literally one-third of it was spent dislodging the Japanese from Alaska for the remainder of the conflict. So they were able to prevent the Americans from taking advantage of Alaska's geostrategic position and bombing Japan. Now, after proactive hostility ceased, the Americans returned to Alaska. They start setting up the HARP installation. Decades later, it takes them decades to put this into place, to get the technology to realize what had been initiated with the Philadelphia experiment, with technology that they were exploiting that they had taken from Nikola Tesla. And when they developed this, it suddenly became occulted when Colonel Aquino began dealing with evocation of extrastellar, extra-dimensional entities. Now, to put this into perspective for people, evocation is the art of bringing alien entities into our world. Invocations are the art of intimately communicating with them, what we would call gnosis, or knowledge. Enchantment is the art of imposing a magician's will upon reality. Divination is the art of extending the magician's sensibilities, what people who are physicists would refer to as remote viewing. Now, during the Aquino influence on the United States Army, evocation became a super science. Evocation is the completion of an equation, the closing of a circuit. Two nodes are created, still points in space-time, creating a world line that the entity can use to navigate, to enter our dimension. Topological symbols, such as the famous elder sign, what the common public refers to as a swastika, is superimposed on one of the nodes, creating an area of hostility, because the Hakenkreuz, or the twisted cross, the swastika, was found to be the symbol which these entities fear the most. That is why the Nazis took it up as a shield, a banishment. And basically, it imprisons in an area of hostility the entity once it's summoned. Then a charge is created. And when once it was necessary to enter gnosis, a very dangerous state of intimate communion with the entity, that to complete that circuit, now the circuit between the two nodes can be charged by alternate power sources. And these days, the 20th century and the 21st, mostly electricity, certainly nuclear, geothermic, or any kind of power can be used to charge that spell. And instead of the use of magic points, the amount of energy used will influence how effective the evocation is. And the use of power and the solution of an equation attracts entities, specific entities, react to specific equations, much like the use of a true name, which the human organism cannot pronounce with human vocal cords. That's why artificial stimulus, certain microphones, were added to human vocal cords where they could pronounce the true names in the calling of the entities, taking the Enochian call to a different technological level where it began to break the fabric of space-time as we knew it within original flux. And at that point, you had people breaking down, because upon the calling of the true name, utilizing the technological adjustments to their vocal cords, most of these people pronouncing those names went mad. They were just washouts of these various programs, thrown onto the streets as raving homeless people and abandoned, like so many breakouts or washouts from the Super Soldier program were.
Right. Just, okay.
And the end result was, what is up in Kokona, Alaska now is an entity that is fixed to a geographic point and constantly needs to be fed. That's why there was so much that went on that made absolutely no sense, that had to do with the mass sacrifice of lives, American lives, foreign lives. They just needed the lives to feed this thing. It's equivalent as Colonel Aquino once said, of imagine a very large man who's held to a table with a thumb cuff. And as long as you keep feeding him, he doesn't care, and he's satisfied. When he stops getting fed, then that bond might be broken, and at that point, all hell literally breaks loose.
Okay.
And so,
I understand this, and this is actually probably quite accurate. As a description of what's going on with regard to HAARP, this entity you're saying, which needs to be fed, as you call it, do you know specifically what they're calling the entity?
I couldn't pronounce it with human vocal cords. That's where.
Well, no, I don't want you to kill yourself. But is there a designation?
There is. I will not say it on the air.
Okay.
And it is certain elements such as this that I harbor that, in a sense, acts as my collateral. But I will tell you that the entity is a specific entity. They are what are known in the military parlance as entropic bombs, as opposed to an atomic or nuclear weapon. This is an entropic weapon, means that it is the manifestation of entropy in itself. In other words, it basically... As compared to the Japanese kami, the German Norse Gotten of the ancient Aryans, the gods of the Aztecs, these are entities which are fed human blood and sacrifice, and in return, they grant fertility of body and field. They grant powers to the people that allow their empire to thrive. These other entities that we're speaking of do no such thing. They're simply weapons of cosmic destruction. They destroy the fabric of space and time itself. They give nothing in return, but the Americans keep feeding them. That was the first use of experiments with feeding them, was the so-called nuclear tests. They had troops standing 2,000 yards from the stems of mushroom clouds in Yucca Flats, Nevada, and then they forced them to march into Ground Zero. The same way with sailors at Eniwetok, Bikini Atoll, Kwajalein Island. All of these sailors surrounding these thermonuclear weapons when they're exploded and then forced to sail through the mushroom cloud. Do you know how many American soldiers and sailors have died in these experiments? 300,000. To put that into perspective for you, that's the equivalent of Hiroshima and Nagasaki's populations combined. And you have to ask why. And the end result is we're not talking science. We're talking Satanism. There's no reason for science to take all those men and march them through a mushroom cloud. You don't need to know they're going to die by doing that. You can figure that out in your head. But they do this to feed that entity. It's been going on for quite some time, even before HAARP was recognized as being established. The end result first was the summoning, then the binding. That's where that comes in. The HAARP is not a summoning agent. It is a binding mechanism.
Okay.
I hope that puts it in perspective.
I hear what you're saying, and it's quite fascinating. Now, let me ask you, was it Michael Aquino that gave you this information, or did you connect some dots, or how did this happen that you came upon this?
Interestingly enough, it was an espionage assignment from the Department of Defense. I was promised a higher grade of pay, a faster rate of promotion, a higher level of security clearance, if I would infiltrate Project Censored at Sonoma State University. Now, to put this into perspective for you, we actually have a speaker, a young man, whose name I actually forget, but he's one of the speakers at ConspiracyCon, can be found on the list. Hopefully you'll meet him personally as well, because he wrote the book on Project Censored. Project Censored was a program set up at Sonoma State University by men like John McLaughlin of the McLaughlin Group, Ted Koppelman, and other big names in journalism. They financed it so that journalism majors at Sonoma State University could prove their mettle as potential investigative journalists by investigating the most underreported stories of the year. So I was assigned by the Department of Defense to find out what kind of information was hemorrhaging concerning HAARP that these students might be finding out about, because they were starting to report on Project HAARP in Gakona, Alaska. So I was dispatched there for 2 semesters. I never did get that promotion, the higher level security clearance or the rate of pay. It turned out, actually, Colonel Aquino had manipulated that assignment to get me off base, because the heat was just too much with everything that had happened to everyone, including himself, after 500 kids, half a thousand is bad enough, came down infected with AIDS. And the whole child daycare center was burned to the ground by all of the angry parents, as well as the community center, which had been burned to the ground by the Army itself, because that's where all the children's records were kept. So the end result was that wanted to clear me off base for a while as his liaison. I knew too much. Got me involved with this assignment where I was basically infiltrating Project Censored.
Was okay, and what year was that?
Oh, that was 1987. And FDA 6, 1986, 87, around that period of time. I was about 20 years old. So that was, at any rate, it was an experience where I was able to collate much more information than the journalism majors themselves could even comprehend or understand. They didn't know what they were looking at. So they were just reporting on HAARP being a bunch of arrays. Now, I could have helped them in exposing it at the time, but at that time I was still bucking for promotion and a career. And the end result was that I wound up destroying a lot of information that would have otherwise reached the public at that time. Probably for the best. There's nobody in the public that would have believed it or even comprehended it. I would speak of such subjects to the student body at Sonoma State University. I'd get nowhere.
That's interesting because I actually went to Sonoma State University many years before that. And I have to say that at that time it was an extremely radical institution. And I actually did study some of my journalistic chops there. If that's where I did learn quite a bit. And I have to say that at least in those days, it was extremely radical. What you're saying is that it wasn't the same in the 87?
Yeah, about 1986. It was around that time. Now, I'd have to look back on my own bio to find out the exact year, to tell you the truth.
The project Censored is highly respected. I believe it's written about in Nexus magazine. I think they have a regular column or something in Nexus.
Absolutely. I'm sorry.
Obviously you were sent to infiltrate them. Is that right?
That's quite correct.
And so what was your relationship or what is your relationship with them now?
None whatsoever. After that two semesters at Sonoma State, I went off in a totally different direction with what else I had to contend with in life, and left that all pretty much behind me. I brought everything.
But did you ever reveal to those people? You never did reveal to them what you had found out.
You mean the people at Project Censored? The actual journalism majors? No. Basically, a lot of the information they were dealing with, they were missing a lot of points. They were interpreting it from a very conventional perspective. I had very poor relations with most of the people at Sonoma State. This is probably tremendously surprising to you because I'm sure that, as you say, I'm not going to guess your age. I'm assuming that that in a sense you're a child of the 60s and very much were exposed to university life during a very radicalized.
Well, I was later than the 60s. Actually, I'm not that old, but.
Sorry, 70s. But, I didn't mean that. I meant 70s. Sorry.
But it was more radical back then. Like I said, it was exceedingly radical. And I interviewed people like Angela Davis.
Yeah.
Wrote for the newspaper and so on and so forth.
I apologize to expose my ignorance. I don't even know. I've heard the name, but I don't even know who she is. But to put this into perspective for you, when I went to Sonoma State University, I would walk down through the dorms. I lived in the dorms. And as you know, the dorms are all named after various wines, Zinfandel and, et cetera, different types of wines. I'm sure it was that way during your day as well, because it's up in wine country. And Sonoma State University is, in a sense, in Roanoke Park, which is kind of like the armpit of wine country up there. But I used to make jokes that the dorms ought to be named after Ripple or Night Train as opposed to some of the more sophisticated wines that they were named after. But the people used to stick their heads out the window and shout at me, "Go back to Korea!" I'm not Korean, by the way.
You're kidding.
This is what I was thinking. No, I'm not kidding.
That's incredible. What a change. Okay. But, you know, I know people don't want to go down memory lane with this, but, we're actually going to close this down in 10 minutes or less. So I just want to sort of give you advance notice of that. But I am fascinated by your conclusions in regard to HAARP. Did you take your conclusions or did you make this sort of this overall summary, did you connect these dots? Did you take it back to the people you were working for or even to Michael Aquino at that time, or did you keep it to yourself?
It's interesting that you say that. There were literally two people I reported to. One of them was the standard bureaucrat at the Department of Defense. The other was Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino at the time. Now, he, of course, was deeply impressed. And as I said, he was looking forward to my full conversion to his cause.
But in
terms of the DOD, you know, they just took it and pretty much did what they do with everything. It's just shelve it, forget it. And as for later on when I'm coming back at them with, hey, what about my promotion in that raise and pay? Hey, you know, then it's like, you know, go away, boy, you bother me. I mean, that's basically what it came down to. You know, it was then, you know, through incidents such as that, that I realized I've got to get out of this. I'm not going to go anywhere with a career in the Department of Defense. That's when I said I need to do something that's high risk. I can make money at right away. I'll get some training at the operational level in military tactics and weaponry. Wasn't going to get that as an officer, so I entered the Marine Corps as an enlisted man so I could get hands up with weaponry real close and working order with it, and then was aiming for a career in mercenary work. There were many mercenaries. Yeah. Go on.
I understand. So at this moment, though, this conclusion that you reached and that you're now talking about, is this something that you have written into a book?
I may at some point. I still respect the confidentiality of my clients during the most important kind of security enforcement contracts that I was serving in, so there's not much I can say about with them for quite some time. That's why I concentrate mostly on my government work. And the reason I don't concentrate too much on the medical industrial complex is because it's still so painful for me. Both of my parents have, comparatively speaking, only recently died, and their terminal decade was the most horrific imaginable. I can tell you, having served in combat in areas and battlefields around the world, nothing is more stressful, are more harrowing, are more destructive to your health than taking care of the elderly, especially when they're someone you love and care about, and watching them disintegrate and die before your eyes.
Extremely difficult. I sympathize with you, and I do understand. Okay.
Thank you.
So what you've said in essence, though, to sum that up, is that you haven't yet written this sort of theory of yours into a book. But I assume you're talking about it at conferences. In other words, I'm not the first person to ask you about this, right?
That's correct. So I will have to get it down in a book as soon as I can. Right now, the books that I'm dealing with have to do with Roswell and the Rising Sun, which will premiere at the Bay Area UFOCon, which will be September 15th of this year. And hopefully we'll see you there as well. Certainly whenever you grace the press with any of these conventions with your presence, it's always a plus. And definitely look forward to personally meeting you.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. And likewise, absolutely. Okay, we are just about to wrap this up. Are there any last minute words that you want to say? Because you're clearly on a sort of a mission at this time. Do you understand the totality of your mission? Are you still finding it out?
Well, I believe that the totality of my mission is based on my communicating as much as I can to the public. This is my fourth career. I've been through three major careers. The last career was care provision for my parents in the terminal decade. It was nothing less than a career. The careers before that were, of course, DOD and then the security enforcement. Now I'm into media communications, and I'm hoping to share with the public and open up a discourse in these matters so that people understand we're entering a new dark age, one in which the demons are very, very real. And I want people to be able to confront those demons from a position of knowledge as opposed to a position of ignorance, because it's only through ignorance that the demons truly hold power over humanity. And that is one thing that Colonel Aquino loved about me. Because I was in charge of documents destruction, he considered me as one of the great genocidals in history. I was committing a form of cultural genocide by depriving future generations of this knowledge, of reality itself. I was keeping them in darkness and ignorance, where they would always be manipulable under the power of wolves such as himself. And that's to put it mildly, and that's an insult to the wolf. But at the same time, you understand what I'm saying. He was very predatory.
Yes.
And predators thrive off ignorance. So let's do our best to combat that with as much enlightenment.
I think that's worth repeating. Predators thrive off innocence.
And ignorant. Yeah,
ignorance.
Both.
Yeah. Both. And so thank you so much, Douglas Dietrich, for coming on the show, for being so gracious as to spend this extra time with us and go into all the various areas you have. Absolutely fascinating. I expected no less, I have to say, after having seen your bio.
I'm honored.
And so it's quite interesting to hear from you directly and to get all of this information. I think that people really do value it. I'm seeing in the chat room that they're just fascinated and stunned by what you have put together, what you've revealed. And so I want to say thank you very much, and hopefully we can do this again.
Absolutely.
And thank you, Revolution Radio, for being so patient with us and giving us extra time.
Yes, bless you all, and thank you for the privilege.
Okay, good night, everyone. Thank you.
Good night.